You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Liz Remerswald-Hughes, who is a member of the Coordinating Committee of World Beyond War, which I am the director of. She is the country coordinator for World Beyond War in New Zealand, or Aotearoa, I'm probably saying that wrong, where she works with a number of peace organizations, including serving as the co-vice president of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF, in New Zealand. In 2017, she was awarded the Sonia Davies Peace Award, which enabled her to study peace literacy in the with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation in Santa Barbara, California, to attend the WILPF Triennial Congress in Chicago, and a workshop on peace and conscience in Ann Arbor. Learn more at worldbeyondwar.org/New Zealand. Liz Remerswald-Hughes, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. And your pronunciation is pretty good. We probably say Aotearoa, New Zealand, but you're pretty good. And just one little clarification. I'm no longer co-vice president of WILPF. I served for a couple of years, but now I mainly focus on the work with World Beyond War and other organizations.
So before we get to what World Beyond War is doing in New Zealand, how did you come to be involved with peace activism in the first place?
Well, I actually come from an environmental background and a political background. And I was an environmental campaigner, involved in some big campaigns, just from a grassroots perspective, you know, from an ordinary person's perspective. We had a big campaign in 2004 where we took our local council to court, and also an American billionaire, Julian Robinson, because the council gave him permission to build a golf course lodge on a protected area that was supposed to have no building on it. So we took them to court. This is a community group and a couple of appellants, and we actually won that case through our Resource Management Act. And so, you know, success is a wonderful thing. And after that, I got involved in politics on our local regional council, which is an environmental protection organisation. And I served for 6 years on that, basically as a sort of a single environmentalist. It was fairly conservative in those days. And so I really, after that, I came into peace politics through WILPF. I attended the Centennial Conference in The Hague of WILPF in 2015, and I really see that peace and environmentalism is strongly linked through resourcing areas, because if we don't waste a whole lot of money on making war, then we can put it towards the things we need: climate change action, sustainability, environmental education, et cetera, as well as health and education and all the goodies that we really need in our world.
Is that trade-off any better understood by most people in New Zealand than it is in the United States, where I would say practically nobody has a clue?
Well, I think probably it is, because we've got more of a tradition of independence. Like, we have our nuclear-free legislation that we passed over 30 years ago. We're really, obviously a really small little country, and we do have, a colonial history and background, and we have supported, you know, the big wars. But we're also probably a little bit more, there's less militarization than there is in the States, for sure. And when I just talk to ordinary people, really, there's not a huge desire or thirst for war making and being involved in wars. So there's more interest in security and so on. But I think as people are becoming aware of what's going on in other countries, and you know, so for example, in Afghanistan and so on, and Iraq, there's a lot of discomfort around there. But having said that, it's a huge mission to try and turn this big ship around because we're part of a global movement. You know, we're part of the Five Eyes Network, which is US, Canada, Australia, Britain, and ourselves, which is, you know, we're very much, the powers that be are very good at working together, and the military is still a very powerful force.
We're at the moment we're doing, as you know, Liz, some work against NATO's militarism and finding that very few people know much about NATO, and what they do know isn't true. I'm guessing many people in the United States and in other countries that are members of the Five Eyes Network haven't even heard of it. Could you enlighten people a little bit?
Oh, the Five Eyes Network?
Yeah.
Well, it's basically about surveillance and global surveillance. And so there's these sort of, you know, satellite stations poised around the world. We've got a couple in New Zealand, one down in the South Island, top of the South Island called Waihopai, which was famously broken into by three men. Nearly 10 years ago, and they managed to pop one of the covers, the balloon-like covers, and they actually got off being convicted for that, which was really good. And there's a huge base in Australia in Alice Springs at Pine Gap, but they're basically and other areas of the world as well, but they're basically. They feed into the US system, the information gathering system. And, you know, it is found out from time to time exactly what they're doing. For example, I think they were spying on Angela Merkel's phone at one point and the Brazilian president, etc. There's this massive network. So it's our taxes that are paying for these things. And we've got no control over what they do. And people who do know about it and who do care very deeply just feel that that they're feeding into this military machine, and that, you know, that children are at risk. Children, the information is being used to drone bomb children, etc. So that's why, you know, there's this people who are prepared to take these actions to try and disarm them. Which is amazing.
We are speaking with Liz Remerswal-Hughes, who is working as the country coordinator, volunteer position, doing great work for World Beyond War in New Zealand. Liz, how did you go about starting a chapter of a new organization, World Beyond War, and how might somebody else somewhere else in the world do the same?
Well, it's about networks, really. There's all lots of ways of doing it, and I really encourage people to be involved. I give a few talks around the place, and, you know, recently we organised a petition for asking our government to stop spending $2.3 billion on 4 Poseidon warplanes that killed submarines. We presented that to Parliament last week, so that was a good way of gathering people into the World Beyond War network. I've organised some meetings in my hometown, and also in conjunction with another local peace group at in one of the churches here. We've had a special kind of ceremony on Hiroshima Day, the anniversary of the Hiroshima bomb. And also I work with the Quaker Network. Quakers is one of the peace churches. Lots of the churches, if they are informed about this stuff, they will be maybe happy to get involved. So it's a matter of starting where you are, really, with the people that you have, the networks you have, organising meetings, organising talks, getting help from World Beyond War. We've got a wonderful part-time team working at World Beyond War who are just amazing and so helpful. And there's a lot of information on the website as well. So, and you know, we're here to help. We've got a coordinators group, a network chapter coordinators group that we talk from time to time. It's wonderful. So this is a big work. I just think that this is going to go on for a long time. This work, I sort of plan to be doing this probably for the rest of my life. I'm not young anymore, so yeah, trying to turn this big ship around.
You started out with some events where you did some talks. I think you also did an event showing a film about the environment and war, right?
Yeah, there's a brilliant film called Scarred Lands and Wounded Lives, which we've shown a few times. We showed it every year. There's this Weapons Expo, Dave, that probably you're familiar with. Where, you know, the Lockheed Martins and so on and the military and the government all to get together and all the people selling stuff to help the military, etc., which, of course, they protest they're not selling guns, but that's been shown not to be true. Anyway, so we kind of, the last few years, we've organised in conjunction with some other peace groups, such as there's a of peace action groups in Auckland and Wellington, which are very, very active. And we worked with them last year. We put on a forum with two prominent speakers in the peace field, and also we showed the film that I mentioned, Scarred Lands and Wounded Lives. And what's brilliant about this film, it connects the war and the environment. And as you know, there's a very strong environmental movement globally now. And, you know, with things such as Extinction Rebellion popping up and so on. But if we partner with that because of the simple reason that war is devastating on the environment, it uses some massive amounts of carbon, which not even counted how much carbon it uses. If we partner with these organisations, it's really, really, really good way of getting our message across. And, you know, we can support the activities that those organisations are doing as well. And this film is a brilliant film to show as a way of people getting involved.
I couldn't agree more. And people can, of course, find that film Scarred Lands at the worldbeyondwar.org website. Liz, what about the petition that you just said you presented to Parliament? Can you tell us a little bit more about what that's about and what the next steps are there?
Yep. So, we have a coalition government here with three parties involved, and obviously it's pretty complicated. But so why we have a brilliant young Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, who campaigned on three particular issues. To get into power, she needed two coalition partners, and one was a party called New Zealand First, which is sort of much more, the Labour Party, Jacinda's party, is more sort of left-wing, Labour-orientated, but the New Zealand First coalition partner is more right-wing, and they nabbed the foreign policy, foreign ministry portfolio, and they also nabbed the Ministry of Defence. And the Minister of Defence is actually an ex-army person, Ron Mark, and he used to be in the army, and I think he was also a mercenary. He served under the Sultan of Oman as well. So for him to get into the military and that ministry, Minister of Defence, is quite a strong position. So recently last year, the defence spending has been going up and up. And last year, they, without going through Parliament or any public discussion, they approved the purchase of these four military planes called Poseidon, which are designed to kill submarines. And $2.3 billion for four planes is a lot of money, but they couch it under the terms of, oh, this is to patrol our waters, this is to protect our fishing areas, etc. And really, when you look into it, you don't need $2 billion worth of plane to do that. You know, we find that it's actually more about the technology and more about being part of a global fleet of planes that we maybe lend to other countries. You know, it's part of this, you know, this big boys network of militarization, so that you know, our planes might end up flying part of the US Army or so on or whatever. So, but a lot of this, when this funding was approved, it kind of went under the radar. I think, you know, sometimes our peace groups or whatever, we drop the ball, we're not aware of things, you know, we're not quick enough off the mark to start saying, what the heck is going on here, guys? So this is what happened with this. It was all passed, the spending's approved, and so we are left with coming up the rear and trying to raise public awareness and try and ask our government to reconsider the spending and maybe to break, you know, the agreement that has been made, and to focus that money on the things that we really need. We've got a housing problem in New Zealand and other things. We've got other priorities. So building public awareness, and there is a lot of support for this change in tech.
When members of the government are compelled to give an explanation, do they claim that these planes are needed for so-called defense, that New Zealand is going to be attacked by submarines, or do they claim that the planes are to take part in good humanitarian wars for the benefit of the world in distant locations, or what?
Well, I think it's a little bit like wolves in sheep's clothing, and they don't know. New Zealand actually has no enemies, and we're not under attack. It's not. It's only sort of fear mongering that, you know, would make us feel that we really needed this kind of thing. I think it's. They say that it's you know, as a thing for our, you know, protecting our fisheries and our. We've got huge sort of huge amount of sea under our nation that we need to maybe patrol or so. But if you look into it, that's actually not the case. And we could actually have $100 million planes that could do that job, not $2 billion worth of spending on these. So it's a matter of educating the public and holding the politicians to account and just really kind of saying, actually, we don't believe you. We think you're probably misrepresenting the case somewhat. Our coalition government also has a Green Party as part of the arrangement as well, and our Green Party spokesperson is very supportive of this as well. So at least we have one party in power working with the government, which is able to raise these issues. But doesn't have a lot of power, actually, compared to the other party, New Zealand First.
And the planes, where are they made?
Where are the planes made? I don't really know. Definitely overseas.
Well,
possibly in the US. I don't know. I have to look that up, David. Sorry.
That's okay. I recommend we find out, because this is one of the things we've found valuable about World Beyond War, is we can go to that country where those planes are made and go after the deal in that location as well.
Yep.
What else are you engaged in terms of education or activism at this point?
Well, this year there's really I'm focusing on building the movement nationally, I don't live in the capital city. I live about 4.5 hours drive from our capital city in Wellington. I live on a beautiful little coastal village on the North Island, just right by the sea. And I was running late this morning, Dave, because I was out swimming. It's so gorgeous in the summer. But last week we held a peace picnic outside Parliament, where we presented our petition to the Green Party MP. And we had about 50 people at the picnic, so we just, you know, took along our sandwiches and our blankets, and you know, we're going to do this on a regular basis. And we partnered with various other organisations, including quite a bunch of young people who are getting politically involved as well. So you know, I kind of wish I lived closer to Parliament, because I'd probably go there once a week and do this if I did, instead of, you know, a bit of a trip down there. But I reckon if we could go down there, you know, every two months and just sit in and just talk, you know, try and talk to the politicians. We just had our national day, Waitangi Day it's called. It's up in Waitangi, which is the north of New Zealand, where our treaty was signed in 1840. Living in New Zealand, I actually met the Prime Minister, well, for the second time, really. They had a barbecue where they were, politicians were making sausages for breakfast after the dawn ceremony. And so I was able to talk to her and just invite her to our peace picnic. And then she was actually in our, I live in near Napier, which is an Art Deco city. There was big earthquake in 1931. And so the city was rebuilt, and so we have a big festival once a year. She was there as well, and this time I got the local MP to introduce me to her, who I know quite well. And so we actually talked about the planes, and she sort of said, oh, you know, I really thought about the spending, and that, you know, we need them for the reasons that I outlined earlier. So, you know, we're really lucky in New Zealand that we can actually have these one-on-one personal conversations with our leaders. It's quite extraordinary. So I don't know, just anything. Where I've noticed that people are starting to talk about this more. I noticed a letter to the editor in the Capital, the one of the main papers in New Zealand the other day, talking about this, and so it's raising public awareness. And it's funny, once it starts. That's really how to get the politicians taking notice, is by when it starts to become an issue, because it hasn't really been an issue up until now. Yeah. And the military are so strong, because, and they have massive resources that we don't have. We're just all a bunch of volunteers, you know, doing this in our spare time. But they've got massive PR campaigns and PR, you know, I don't know how many journalists they employ. They are very good at going into schools and giving, you know, flying their helicopters and so on. And, you know, this whole myth of that military is glamorous and exciting and, you know, how don't they look smart in their uniforms, and we can give you scholarships for your kids so that they can, you know, become engineers and so on, and all this. You know, this is what we're competing with. You know, I mean, everybody needs jobs and so on, and But well, I think what we're trying to turn it around and say, well, look, okay, well, let's keep, maybe, you know, maybe keep the military, but using it for a force of good in terms of dealing with climate change events and disasters and so on, helping people rather than, you know, killing people.
Well, as long as it ceases to be a military and they don't use guns or anything else of pretty much everything they have now to do that, I'd be in favor of it. We have just a few minutes left. Liz Remerswell-Hughes, you have been able to travel to World Beyond War events in Canada and in the United States. I know, because I've seen you there. Have those been helpful in terms of your work back in New Zealand?
It's very inspiring to meet people like yourself, David, and the other campaigners, because sometimes it feels pretty lonely. And you know, working with people, it's great to have the face-to-face experience. I've also been to Australia a couple of times and worked with some of the Australian peace activists and so on. And building the global movement is very important. It helps me to learn what's going on. It gives me ideas of what techniques to use. Like I went down to Washington to the Code Pink House in D.C., and, you know, had a week with those amazing women there. And it happened to be the week of the Kavanaugh hearing. And so we were protesting outside the Supreme Court. We were bird dogging in the Senate offices. And that really just gave me a whole bunch of energy and enthusiasm to bring back home, to think, well, okay, let's us go into Parliament and talk to the politicians. So, you know, it's very expensive, it's a long way, it's burning a lot of carbon, which I feel guilty about. But if I can take it home and bring it home and make it really worthwhile and inspire other people and get people on board, then it's really worthwhile.
Well, we are looking at Ireland possibly for our next big annual conference, maybe somewhere in New Zealand in a future year.
It would be a great honour to host you in New Zealand, David. Let's work towards that for the year after, shall we?
I'm in favor if we come up with a good plan and everybody else agrees. I can't decide by myself, but I think that would be terrific. Do you think
it is a long way away? But you know, the good thing about having a conference is it energizes people and brings people together. And as long as we, as long as lots of good things come out of it, then it is, you know, I kind of justify it on the grounds that if we're making a good impact, it's just a tiny fraction compared to what the military is burning, you know, probably every day of the week. So, but at the same time, we can do a lot with our technologies through Zoom conferencing, you know, just through all the other media that's available to us as well.
For sure. We've got about 1 minute left. How can people learn more, stay in touch, help out from afar?
Well, I think looking for people of like minds, talking to them and saying, let's get together, you know, you know, the environmental movement. I mean, there's a lot to do with, I've been studying up about nonviolent direct action. And that's a really good way of making a stance. There's a big continuum of actions that people can do, from whether it's letter writing or whether it's out on the front line. I think the best thing is just to talk about it with people of like mind and just making a start. Everything is good.
Well, we have been speaking with someone of like mind, Liz Remerswall-Hughes, who is a member of World Beyond War's Coordinating Committee and leading up World Beyond War's efforts in New Zealand. Liz, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Lovely to chat with you, and all the very best of luck.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the summit between Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un ended without an official agreement. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? You won't learn from reading the New York Times editorial, which both lauds a step-by-step process by which both sides agree to take corresponding action, and says that outreach to dictators like Mr. Kim erode the moral foundation that for generations has supported American diplomacy and the notion of America's role in the world. The last thing you'll get from U.S. media's assessment of the prospect of peace on the Korean Peninsula, what Koreans think. We'll talk about the just-concluded summit with journalist Tim Shorrock. Also on the show, when the New York Times talks about the moral foundation supporting American diplomacy, you have to wonder, do they mean diplomats like Elliot Abrams, holder of a number of titles in the Reagan and George W. Bush administrations and now special envoy for Donald Trump in Venezuela? And if they do, do most Americans understand what media's definition of the word diplomacy or the word moral really entails? We'll talk about Elliot Abrams and the press with John Schwartz, journalist for The Intercept. That's coming up this week on Counterspin. We're told the summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un has ended with no agreement. That may be received as good news by, say, the former CIA chief of staff that MSNBC brought on to warn viewers that Trump's bromance would lead him to cave on nuclear weapons, and to the think tank expert whose op-ed in the LA Times explained that the long-sought-after recognition of the end of the Korean War might sound innocuous, but is actually dangerous, because it might lead to a real peace treaty on the peninsula and, quote, if South and North Korea were to be in a formal state of peace, what would be the rationale for keeping 28,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, close quote. You can be forgiven for being unsure exactly what's going on here, but we would hope that a baseline idea would be that arguments against peace should get serious scrutiny. Joining us now to talk about the Hanoi summit and Korea peace talks is journalist Tim Shorrock, author of Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tim Shorrock.
Hello, thank you.
Well, the fear, as far as I could understand it, was that Trump in this summit was going to agree to loosen sanctions or allow for a peace declaration on the peninsula without North Korea agreeing to eliminate all of its nuclear weapons capacity first. Or, as an expert source told USA Today, quote, we've said this over and over. If you choose to give up nuclear weapons, you can have a better life, close quote. But then we also heard the idea that the de-escalation of tensions between North and South Korea would itself be bad. Well, for somebody. I don't know that the outcome of the Hanoi summit is going to shake up media's basic storyline. What are we seeing here? What's going on?
Basically, a complete inability to tell the story, see the story through Korean eyes. Like, for example, when last year, when Trump and Kim met in Singapore for the first ever meeting between a U.S. president and a North Korean leader, they agreed on a set of principles, which was, number one, establish a new relationship between U.S. and North Korea. Number two, that they would establish a peace process on the Korean Peninsula and you know, work with South Korea to deepen a peace process. And three, that they would work toward the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And so for a lot of the press, they just see that as the first two elements of that aren't even considered.
Right.
That's the framework. For example, I woke up yesterday to turn on MSNBC when the very first, when the summit was just beginning, right? And Mika Brzezinski from MSNBC, she just said over and over again, you know, meeting with a murderous dictator who starves his people, murderous dictator who starves his people, murderous dictator who starves his people. I mean, it's a form of propaganda. So, you know, yes, he's a dictator, but actually, no, people are not starving anymore, but that doesn't seem to matter. But they just say this over and over again to just denigrate the whole idea of meeting someone like that. And you know, the fact that the two leaders are meeting and trying to work out a peace is just seen as a negative and even almost a crime. I mean, here's what's ironic about it is her father, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was, you know, the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter when he was president in, you know, 1980, when there was a murderous dictator in South Korea who, when there was a rebellion against the military government of South Korea, the U.S. under Carter helped put that rebellion down. They decided to side with the military one day after this murderous dictator had killed hundreds of people in a southern city in Korea. And Brzezinski, her father, was directly involved in that. He's the guy that really, you know, set the policy. So apparently she doesn't even know the history of her own family. But, I mean, it's just this unbelievable hypocrisy.
Well, I think it has to seem a little bit funny to people just coming to it earnestly, reading these articles, that the United States gets to decide when tensions end between North and South Korea, that the Pentagon gets to nix, you know, improved railways between the North and the South, you know, and you sort of get the feeling from coverage that South Korea really can't be trusted with their own interests, which I guess they're meant to say are our interests. It's confusing genuinely if you are not a cynical person to understand where someone who believes in peace and a de-escalation of tensions should find themselves in all of this.
Right, it is. It's terribly confusing for people. The attitude toward North Korea is one thing. And then the attitude toward South Korea among the mainstream media is that basically doesn't exist as a country. It's like a colony. They're supposed to just do whatever we say. And you know, a lot of times articles are written and reports are made that, you know, yeah, like you said, don't trust the South Koreans. They're moving too fast and, you know, making peace with the North. I mean, this is their own country. This is a war that ripped apart their country. You know, 4 million Koreans at a minimum died. Maybe, you know, 35, 36,000 American soldiers and soldiers from other countries as well. But, I mean, it was a terrible, terrible war.
There's an extra muddling to the picture because for some media, the problem seemed to be if Donald Trump gets any kind of a deal, we'll never hear the end of it. You know, and he'll ask himself to get the Nobel Peace Prize, and then all our heads will explode. Hatred of Donald Trump is not a legitimate reason to oppose a negotiation. And I just want to ask you finally, like, what do you, people interested in peace, what should we be looking for in terms of the media coverage coming out of this summit?
Well, I think we should look to see if it continues the same. I mean, what we've been seeing over the last few months is a stream of reports based on, you know, think tanks like the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is funded by the military-industrial complex, and some governments like the U.S. and Japan. But they get a lot of money from defense contractors that assert that, you know, North Korea has, you know, continued to, you know, build its nuclear weapons and missiles while these talks have been going on. And first of all, there's a fallacy behind the reports in general because there is no agreement yet.
Right.
I mean, the United States hasn't stopped deploying its nuclear weapons aimed at North Korea that are stationed on ships and planes in the you know, Pacific, you know, in Japan and Guam. Yes, the hatred of Trump and the desire to kind of, you know, nail him and get him is so clear in the reports. I mean, last night, watching this live press conference from Hanoi, a few White House reporters got called on at the beginning, but then he started taking questions from you know, South Korean and Chinese reporters and some a couple British reporters, and who were all interested in what had happened and how the talks had apparently failed. The fourth question was from Jonathan Carl of ABC News. He immediately, you know, asked him about the, you know, the test lawyer.
The Michael Cohen.
Michael Cohen, right. And then after the press conference, they, you know, when these network people do these stand-ups, right, they're all complaining that Trump had not gotten questions from the White House press, instead had gone to the foreign press, because they all wanted to ask about Cohen. I mean, they're so wrapped up in this, as if, you know, Korea as a country just doesn't exist to them. You know, the White House press corps, by and large, is not even providing, you know, the information that Americans need to understand what's going on.
Well, I'm going to end it there, and thank you very much. We've been speaking with journalist Tim Sharrock. You can still find his piece, Why Are Democrats Trying to Torpedo the Korea Peace Talks, and other related work online at thenation.com. Tim Sharrock, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Difficult as it is for some of us to believe, there are many people for whom Elliot Abrams' appointment as Donald Trump's special envoy to Venezuela is their first introduction to the man, a recent Washington Post headline described as trailed by mistrust. Abrams' public record in Latin America and elsewhere as an official under Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush ought to be central in any reporting on his current Venezuelan adventure. But it only really got on media's front burner when Abrams was confronted with it by Representative Ilhan Omar in a House Foreign Affairs Committee meeting, an exchange then subsumed in media's hot controversy of the day framework. Joining us now to talk about some of Elliot Abrams' keenly relevant and not that old history is John Schwartz, contributor to many outlets. He now writes for The Intercept. He joins us by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, John Schwartz.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about this. It's an extremely grim story, but also extremely important.
Well, after the exchange with Representative Omar, Elliot Abrams sent a message to the Washington Post that described his role in the Reagan administration, saying, quote, "It's a remarkable record of support for Latin democracy, of which Representative Omar is obviously unaware and in which she is uninterested," close quote. And he added, "That was clear from her conduct, which constituted attacking rather than questioning a witness." The idea that Omar was speaking from ignorance, set aside her purported incivility as the conduct with which we should be concerned, but the idea that she was factually wrong, that she doesn't know her history, for reporters to let that stand as if to say who's right depends on who you like, it feels like an abdication of duty. So I wanted to ask you to talk about Elliot Abrams' public record, some of which you have revisited recently. We don't have time to do it all justice, but what leaps to mind when you hear Abrams tout his support for Latin democracy?
Yeah, well, Elliot Abrams supported Latin American democracy pretty much like Jeffrey Dahmer supported all the people that he brought to his apartment. That seems like a crazy thing to say to people who are not familiar with Abrams' history. It actually is not. Like, I'm choosing Dahmer specifically because a famous forensic anthropologist visited Guatemala to help excavate the mass graves there, many of them from the 1980s when Abrams was helping to support the Guatemalan government and make sure that it had all the arms and training that it needed for its military. And that anthropologist said this, you know, it's a shame that Jeffrey Dahmer never came here to Guatemala, because if he had, he would have ended up as a general. The violence that Elliot Abrams supported in Latin America during the 1980s, particularly in El Salvador and in Guatemala, is unspeakable. human beings literally do not have the words to describe this kind of thing. And all we can do is use the limited vocabulary that we do have to try to communicate it.
Right. And, you know, I think in particular, when Omar was asking him about El Salvador, if we can start with that, because it isn't just that he described what happened in Salvador as a, I think, a, was his words, a fabulous achievement. I'm not sure, but just that for years afterwards, he continued to deny that any horrors had taken place, right?
That's right. Elliot Abrams in the early 1990s was asked about, you know, his involvement with U.S. policy towards Central America and El Salvador specifically. And he called what happened in El Salvador a fabulous achievement. Well, here's part of the fabulous achievement. Elliot Abrams became Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs on December 12, 1981. Literally when he walked into his office, the Salvadoran military, which was just off of being trained and armed by the United States, was conducting one of the most notorious mass slaughters anywhere on Earth over the past 40 years or so. This took place in El Mozote, which is a small town near the Honduran border in the mountains of El Salvador. It was kind of My Lai times two or three. Around 1,000 people were killed, men, women, and children. Every woman over the age of maybe 10 was raped before being murdered. It is as gruesome as pretty much anything in human history. So he walks into office as the Assistant Secretary of State, let me say this again, for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs, and he snaps into action and covers it up.
I mean, I really actually want to talk about language here, because it's almost as if the stuff that you're talking about is on the record. It isn't that folks deny that these things actually happened. It's as if, yes, they happened, but you have to look at it through a particular lens. And so I want to say, like, you almost don't have to hide this record of what Elliot Abrams did in Latin America if you are going to at the same time say that, for example, in Venezuela, well, we're going to push for a coup for democracy, you know, and you're just going to say those words with a straight face. And so in some ways, the lying, and you've written about this, the lying and the PR and the massaging of the truth is as much a part of what we know need to know about Elliot Abrams as what he actually supported.
Yeah, just the language is remarkable. It is like someone saying, you know, well, I'm a doctor, so I'm going to shoot you in the face for your health. And the El Mozote story, this is very much a media story. One of the things that Abrams and his compatriots in the Reagan administration did when Raymond Bonner was a New York Times reporter, got into El Mozote, he broke the story of what had happened there 6 or 7 weeks afterward. And the Reagan administration did everything they possibly could to try to, you know, knock the story down. They attacked Raymond Bonner personally, and they succeeded. Like, they went straight to his editors at the New York Times, and they got him pulled off of his assignment in Central America, brought back to New York, put on a desk that was a clear demotion. And it really just derailed his career, frankly, for decades. And so that's what happens when you report the truth in the New York Times. If you're going up against Elliot Abrams, you are going to be punished, and punished severely.
Well, and that record of his involvement with the press is part of his record, you know. And for some folks, as you've noted, it isn't just that he, well, I mean, it is that he attacks them, but it's also that he kind of breaks them, you know. reporters that are trying to rely on him as a source and trying to report reality from areas in which he has influence, kind of, some of them just get kind of worn down, it sounds like.
Yeah, I wrote about one who was working for the Washington Post and had to deal with Abrams. And she later said that, you know, they said that black was white. Although I'd used all of my professional resources, I had misled my readers. And she just found dealing with them so unbearable and exhausting that she quit to write novels.
Well, and then, you know, I guess I have to come back to, you've started to talk about, or you've indicated some of the actual horrors. You know, horrors is the right word for what was done under U.S. auspices and with U.S. support in Salvador, in Guatemala, in, we could also talk about, you know, Nicaragua, for example. And let's talk about actually Nicaragua, because that will be another example that for many folks might be, oh, wait, he has something to do with Iran-Contra. But this brings us back to journalists are now going to be going to Abrams, quoting him as a source. And these are journalists who have to know that he has a record of lying and proudly lying to Congress about U.S. Involvement in Nicaragua.
That's right. He's best known for, you know, if he's known for anything, is that he pled guilty to two counts of withholding information from Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. And when this happened, you know, everybody kind of thought, well, that's it. You know, you can't lie to Congress and, you know, return to the U.S. government at some point. And that's the funny thing about Elliot Abrams. He was pardoned by George Bush number one, as George Bush number one was on his way out the door after losing to Bill Clinton in 1992. Now, he pardoned a whole bunch of Iran-Contra people. One of them was Abrams, so his record was wiped clean. And that was the end of his career, you know, in the Reagan administration, but he would return later on for George W. Bush and do pretty much the same stuff.
Which is funny because they thought maybe he couldn't get Senate approval, but they found a way around that.
Yeah, that's right. So they put him onto National Security Council positions, again, with names in his titles, like involving human rights and democracy. And it's kind of like John Bolton, who's Trump's national security advisor. Like, it would be very tough to get a Bolton nomination through the Senate. And so you can stick these people in the National Security Council, which does not require that kind of approval.
And they can have enormous, enormous influence, which I think, you know, we're seeing right now. You know, now Abrams is being covered in the context of Trump administration policy in Venezuela. And we're seeing, for example, stories about whether or not weapons might be smuggled in humanitarian supplies. And it's almost as if, let's come to that as though it's a new thing, you know, with regard to Abrams. Missing the history is always a bad idea for media. But when it comes to Abrams, it really means missing the story.
It is incredible. It is like, you know, reporting on Elvis Presley and be like, is it possible that this fellow might like to sing some songs? You know, I mean, like, this is what Elliot Abrams does. Of course you have to expect they're going to be smuggling arms and then humanitarian supplies. Like, he did that in the past. He's in charge now. Probably that's what he has in mind.
Nowhere along the line did he say, that was a mistake. I'm changing my ways, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if he were truly remorseful for what he did in the past, he would not be getting hired again.
Well, let's come back to media. I wonder if I can ask you, because I do think it's the big story in some ways. You wrote in a recent piece, you reminded readers about when Elliot Abrams was on Charlie Rose with Alan Nairn, and he kind of said, you know, here's what I'm about, and here's how you should deal with it. Can you remind us of that story?
Yes. So this was 1995. Abrams was on the Charlie Rose Show with Alan Nairn, you know, who is one of the best and most knowledgeable reporters about U.S. foreign policy. And Nairn said that George Bush number one, this is again 1995, had talked about putting Saddam Hussein on trial for crimes against humanity. And Nairn said, you know, like, that's a good idea, but if you're serious, you're going to have to be even-handed. And so you're going to have to prosecute people like this guy that I'm on the show with, Elliot Abrams. And Elliot Abrams found this idea, you know, preposterous and chuckled about it and says, like, well, you know, if you want to do that, that would mean putting all the American officials who won the Cold War in the dock. And that actually is a pretty fair point from Abrams. It's not like he somehow fooled Ronald Reagan, that he fooled George W. Bush. I mean, they knew what he was doing. He was doing what they wanted him to do. And this is U.S. foreign policy. This is what it's like. You know, there are doves and there are hawks, but the difference between them is not that great. And if you were going to put the hawks on trial, if you're going to be honest about it, you're going to have to put a lot of the doves there too. And so to me, this kind of stuff is always like murder on the Orient Express, right? So somebody ended up dead. And the question is, well, who killed them? You know, the story is, well, there are, I think, 13 possible suspects on the train, 13 passengers. The answer is they all did it.
Right.
They all committed the crime. You know, Abrams sees that as a very powerful defense, and it is. Like, the U.S. foreign policy elite does not like the idea of all of them going to jail together.
I kind of feel that elite media co-sign that line of thinking, you know, that they sort of play both sides in terms of their foreign policy coverage. This is for grown-ups, you know. You just got to accept as access to the conversation that, you know, we kill people and we do that to protect our stuff, you know. And then out of the other side of their mouths, they say, this is for the babies, you know. Don't you care about the poor babies? I mean, you know,
Why don't you care about the babies like we care about the babies?
Exactly. I just finally... For those of us trying to make sense of the world with media, how do you even do that? I mean, you can't rely on corporate press.
You know, I would encourage everybody to, you know, watch Game of Thrones. And there are a lot of great scenes in Game of Thrones, which I think demonstrates how these people look at the world, you know, particularly the character of Tywin Lannister, where it's like, look, somebody has to rule the world. Here we are. We're ruling it. Anybody who's going to rule the world is going to have to do this kind of stuff. So get over it. And in the end, it's for the best for everyone. And that really is how the U.S. media sees things, you know. And if you push them on how they don't really seem to care about a lot of babies on Earth, they'll retreat to that perspective. Like, look, this is just the way the world is, and suck it up and deal with it.
Right. Well, I guess finally, for those of us who don't subscribe to that, we need to find other outlets for our conversations and other folks to include in those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is that we have 99% of humanity on our side. So hopefully eventually that will count for something.
We've been speaking with John Schwartz. You can find his work on a variety of issues on TheIntercept.com. John Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you to everybody listening. I mean, this truly is an important story, and I think that it really deserves everyone's attention.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. The show is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York, online at fair.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
He set the climate conversation on fire with his 2017 article in New York Magazine, where he is deputy editor and climate columnist. Now American journalist David Wallace Wells is back with his new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before you wrote the most popular article in New York Magazine, you covered the new science beat, stuff like gene editing, robots, sometimes the arts. David, what turned you into a climate columnist?
I was just seeing so much scary news from the scientific research that I felt wasn't being written about properly or honestly in most places like the place that I worked. And I felt, as a kind of consumer of that news, frustrated that, say, when I read accounts of climate change in the New York Times and Washington Post, even accounts that I admired, I felt that they were shying away from some of the scarier possibilities and turning away from some of these storytelling opportunities that those possibilities opened up. And I felt that there was a big gap there that needed to be filled from a narrative point of view. It needed to be filled from a political point of view. It needed to be filled from, you know, the perspective of advocacy and hope for making a difference with the planet. And for all those reasons, yeah, I started writing a kind of more cinematic and maybe alarmist kind of way about climate change, which is how I saw it. And that's led me to where I am now, which is writing this book that is, you know, not just about the science, but about all of the ways that our life promises to be transformed by climate change if we don't do anything about it. So that's politics and geopolitics, culture and relationship to technology, our perspective on capitalism and all that. I do think that there's basically nothing, no life on the planet that will be untouched by climate change over the next few decades, and no aspect of life either. That's how total it is. That's how all-encompassing it is. And we haven't really yet begun to think about what it will mean for the way that we live. My book is a kind of effort to do that.
I love that you've done that. I interview a lot of climate scientists, but they can't really put in that social perspective. Okay, this is what life could be like if what I'm saying is true.
Yeah, and it's quite horrifying, really, when you look squarely at the science. You see that the impacts are quite dramatic and quite punishing. You know, if we're on track for 4 degrees of warming by the end of the century, which is the kind of conventional view of the UN IPCC and other bodies, that will mean probably hundreds of millions of climate refugees. It will mean the total loss of probably all Arctic ice, although that'll take centuries to unfold. It'll mean a global GDP that could be 20% or more smaller than it is today, more than twice as much war than we have today. Just about everywhere you look, there are completely crippling, horrifying impacts that we're scheduled to encounter as a result of this warming. And I think as a result, many people, even those people who are kind of concerned about climate change, tend reflexively to look away because these outcomes are horrifying and they're also almost impossible to believe because you can't really square them with an understanding of the modern world as it exists today. And I think that that's, you know, a natural response. It's a human response. It's a response that I have myself sometimes. But I also think it's an irresponsible one because if the science is telling us that the future is going to be so different that the modern world that we take for granted can't endure as it is, we shouldn't assume that the modern world will endure and the science is wrong. We should take seriously what those scientists are telling us about just how fragile our contemporary infrastructure is and just how damaged it could be by these forces, which is really significantly.
Just this month, you told the Guardian newspaper, people should be scared. I'm scared. There are new nuclear weapons on the horizon, angry terrorists, a really suspect president, and plastic in our guts. We live in scary times, so why freak out about climate change in particular?
My view is that it is the story. It is the big threat. It is the one that contains all the other challenges that we face. And by that, I mean, whatever your political commitments, whether you're concerned about income inequality or, you know, gender equality, whether you're concerned about domestic assault or crime, whether you're concerned about mental health issues, all of these things are touched by climate change, some of them quite dramatically. So, you know, we know that for every degree of warming, grain yields will fall by about 10%. That means if we get to 4 degrees of warming, we could have agricultural yields that were half as bountiful as they'd be without climate change. We're not living in a world that is without hunger now. Climate change is only going to make that worse. We're not living in a world without conflict now, but for every half degree of warming, we'll see between 10 and 20% increase in conflict. So if we get to 4 degrees, we'll have, as I said earlier, probably as much as twice as much war. And those temperature impacts happen at the individual level too. So assault, robbery, rape, everything about the way that we live in the world will be affected and in most cases deformed. And as a result, I've come to see really over the last few years, this isn't how I saw it a few years ago, but I see it now as the entire system in which we live, the theater in which we conduct all of these other experiments, political, social, romantic, cultural, and the terms of those experiments are set by climate. I used to think as a New Yorker, as a lifelong urbanite, that I lived outside of nature, that it was nature was something that happened when I went on vacation and looked out the window. But the more I understand about climate science, the more I realize it sounds so naive to say, but the more I realize we live within nature. You walk down the street, even in the most advanced city in the world, you're living within nature. And because you live within nature, you're living within climate change. And when you think in particular about the economic effects and the effects on conflict, you understand that, you know, this is not a story about coastlines and sea level rise. It is touching absolutely every aspect of the way that we live on the planet. We haven't really yet reckoned with that. We haven't really begun to think about what it means that we are now living on a planet that is warmer than has ever been the case in the entire history of humanity. So no human has ever walked a planet as hot as this one. To me, that means it's an open question whether humans would have ever evolved in the first place if the planet had always been this hot. I think they probably would have, but it's a question. And certainly whether we would have developed agriculture and through agriculture civilization if the planet had always been this hot, because the parts of the world where we did invent agriculture, the Middle East, are now suffering from terrible droughts and famines as a result of climate change. That gives you a sense of just how precarious this whole experiment, this whole human experiment, which people like me, as a kind of child of the 90s, a child of the end of history, were led to believe were permanent, eternal, unending, triumphant. How actually precarious all of what we know as modern life is and how vulnerable it is to disruptions from the climate, which are getting more intense by the day. And over the course of decades, if we don't change course, we'll become really dramatically more intense.
Chris Hayes on MSNBC says covering climate is a ratings killer. And you just passed through a long row of interviews about your new book. David Wallace Wells, what is your assessment of the state of media coverage on climate change? Do they get it now, or is it just a sensational new draw?
I think things are changing actually quite rapidly on this point. For a long time, there was a kind of narrow consensus among scientists and, as a result, among journalists about what kind of story it was responsible to tell about climate change. And the recent upsurge in activism and the recent IPCC report, among other factors, have really opened up this space so that we're hearing from many more voices telling many different kinds of stories. And even in the kind of state establishment institutions, we're seeing a much higher volume of coverage of climate because the world is waking up to it and the media responds to audience. One reason we're seeing that is just many more people are concerned, they're engaged, they want to read stories about it, and nobody thought that that was possible a few years ago. I think the change is in part because of new kinds of storytelling, but it's also just because the political winds are blowing in that direction. The sort of gold standard for public opinion about climate comes from Yale. They do an opinion survey. And the number of Americans who believe climate change is real and happening now is 73%. The number of Americans who are concerned about climate change is 70%. Those numbers are up each about 15% since 2015, and they're up about 8% since March. So things are moving quickly, and you see that very clearly in the activism, in the kind of grassroots activism with Greta Thunberg and the climate strike in Europe, with Extinction Rebellion, with the Green New Deal even in the U.S. It's our politics are moving very, very quickly because our public opinion is moving quickly. And I think our media is playing along. It's along for the ride. It's wanting to tell the story of our time as more and more people see it as the story of our time.
Critics say we shouldn't frighten people. It just numbs them into inaction. You said fear may be the only thing that saves us. How could that work, David?
Well, I think about my own experience. So I was somebody who was concerned about climate as an average American liberal, generic, relatively well-off American liberal, concerned about climate change, but thought it was one issue among many we were facing, and I had some faith that our leaders would take action on it. I've come over time to see as I was saying before, just how all-encompassing this threat is, how dramatic it is, and how much it promises to punish us and the lives of our children and our grandchildren if we don't take action. And I've been awakened out of that complacency by fear. When I look around the world, when I look around my, you know, my friends, my colleagues, when I walk down the street, when I watch television, it seems really transparently the case to me that complacency about climate change is a bigger problem than fatalism about climate change. And for that reason, I think that fear can be a helpful motivator because it did that. It played that trick on me. It pulled me out of complacency and made me engaged. But I think you also see that in the social science. There was a big paper that was published in Nature at the end of 2017, actually in response to my New York Magazine article earlier in that year, that surveyed all of the literature about climate messaging and said that despite what scientists may have told you, that there's really only one responsible way to talk about climate using notes of hope and optimism. In fact, basically, all kinds of storytelling are useful. You can't predict who will respond to what kind of story. And so there's no need to edit your approach beforehand, including with alarm. And when I look back on the history of environmental advocacy and activism, I see many, many instances of, you know, when fear and alarm were useful in mobilizing public opposition. You know, most notably, perhaps, Rachel Carson and Silent Spring. That book was decried as alarmist and hyperbolic and misleading when it was first published. It led to the eradication of DDT, which was a huge advance. It almost single-handedly led to the creation of the EPA, which is also hugely important. And when we talk about public campaigns across the spectrum, from, you know, against carcinogenic pesticides, against nuclear proliferation, against cigarette smoking.
But we can't live in a continual state of panic or fear. I mean, let's say we don't go to fake optimism. What can really follow? Is it despair? Is it action? What?
It seems sort of intuitive that alarmism can lead to action. You know, the UN, in its report from October, said that to avoid catastrophic warming, what we needed was a global mobilization of the scale of World War II. We know that that war was fought out of fear and alarm, not out of hope and optimism, although there were notes of hope and optimism in that. And I think we need that kind of action, that scale of response now. I think that's what the scientific community tells us, and I think we should credit it. Now, exactly what form that takes, I'm not yet entirely sure, but I have to say I'm really heartened by how much movement on this issue has happened in American politics, which was long held up as a global laggard on this issue. The Democratic Party has moved dramatically on climate just over the last few years. And because, you know, the polling on public opinion has moved so much, it's hard to imagine the Republican Party won't respond too. The question is whether they'll do so and come around quickly enough to really avert our worst case outcomes. And on that point, I'm a bit agnostic or even skeptical, unfortunately. But, you know, for me, whether you call the response to the science fear or alarm or urgency or aggressive action, these are, to me, semantic distinctions. The important thing is to understand that we're facing a threat that is global, existential, and all-touching. Whatever that looking at that science makes you feel or do is a good and proper response. We shouldn't hide from it. We should learn from it and take action on the basis of it, which means really dramatically, even radically, reimagining much of the way we do business in the world. Everything that we do, when, from the time we get up in the morning to the time we go to sleep, has some kind of carbon footprint, and we need to do everything we can to reduce that impact as quickly as possible. So the more dramatic the response, I think the better, and especially if that dramatic response can put pressure on our policymakers so that they can take aggressive action, that's really the best path forward, because for all the virtue in living within a small carbon footprint as an individual, the impact of one life is really ultimately trivial to the big problem. The important thing, the most important thing, is political change, and that happens through mobilization and simply voting.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is New York Magazine deputy editor and climate columnist David Wallace Wells. We are talking about his new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. Now, David, when I picture what you mean by uninhabitable, I also picture the actual land space of Earth shrinking due to sea level rise. You know, deltas will be invaded and storm surges will wash into existing cities and make some of them useless. Is that the sort of thing that you are also talking about in your book?
There are many contributing factors. I should say I don't think that totally uninhabitable Earth is likely any time on any time scale it makes sense to imagine. So over the next number of centuries, I don't think it will be the case that, you know, humanity will be made extinct by climate change. But it is conceivably possible, and the fact that we've brought it into the realm of conceivability, even if it's vanishingly unlikely, is a kind of dramatic indictment of the way that we've behaved over the last couple of decades. And I should say one of the big points of emphasis in the book is really just how quickly we've done this damage. So we often think of climate change as the legacy of the Industrial Revolution. So we think of it as being several centuries old. But half of all the carbon emissions that we've put into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels have come in the last 30 years. So that's since Al Gore published his first book on warming. It's since the premiere of Seinfeld. We're really doing this damage in real time. And what that will mean to the map of the Earth is transformative on every level. So you mentioned coastlines, you mentioned the flooding of deltas, but it will also increase deserts. It will make what was once quite bountiful agricultural land much less bountiful. It will increase the footprint of wildfires so that by the end of the century, if we stay on our current emissions course, it's predicted that California wildfires will burn 64 times as much acreage as they burned this past year when they burned more than a million acres. 64 times as much. And there are those kinds of impacts just about everywhere you look. The melting of glaciers, you know, the impact on animal life and their ecosystems, the effect on plant growth. Some places, in some ways, heat increases plant growth. In other ways, it damages it. But the whole shape and context and face of the planet will be impacted by these forces. And we're only beginning with extreme weather and wildfires in particular to understand really just how total that impact will be. But as you say, it's everywhere you look.
We're hearing more about mass death and extinctions in the insect world. And on February 20th, CNN reported a small brown rat in Australia is the first mammal known to have gone extinct directly due to climate change. David, do you share my worry that a lot is happening in the miniature world with the small creatures that we just don't know about, and that could pile up into some real surprises for us in the future?
It's hard to know exactly what to make of the reports of the sort of the insect Armageddon, as it's been called. It seems clear that at least in isolated areas in particular studies that the population drops have been unbelievably dramatic, you know, in some places as much as 75% in just a couple of decades. It's a little bit hard for me to believe that those numbers would hold up at the global scale, just because I think we would have already seen quite dramatic, catastrophic, cascading impacts from that if there really were 75% less insects than there were 20 years ago. But I also think that it's not something to be blithe about because those drops could come soon. So even if we've only lost, say, 20% of all insects on the planet, that's dramatic enough, and we're going to be continuing to imperil their future. That could make things really, really bad, especially for plant growth, since so many plants depend on insects for pollination. The mammal numbers are perhaps even more startling. The World Wildlife Foundation says that I think 50% of all vertebrate mammals have died since 1970. That's just an astonishing number. We've had mass extinctions on the planet before. We've had five of them. Nothing has ever happened at nearly the speed that we're going through now, because nothing has ever changed the climate of the planet nearly as dramatically or nearly as quickly as we are doing today. So when you hear from kind of climate skeptics or climate deniers, well, the planet's been this hot before, it's been through transitions like this before, that is true, but the transitions were much, much, much slower, literally unfolding over millions of years when we're now talking about years and decades, but also never before in the history of humanity. So the animal life of the planet was wiped almost entirely clean, and the biology started almost from scratch every time. That's what we mean when we say mass extinction, and that is what we're living through right now. So what that means for human life, because we're an adaptable species, I really don't think there's much chance that we go extinct anytime soon. But the kind of transformation that we're looking at when we have half of all animal life dying, if we have three-quarters of all insect life dying, in addition to all of the impacts on agriculture from sea level, from public health, economic growth, conflict, all those things, when you add these things up, it is just an awe-inspiring spectacle of devastation. And that is the story that we're walking into now. Now, we're still the protagonist of that story. These things are not outside of our control. And in fact, the flip side of the scale of just what kind of horrors are possible is that we are that powerful. If we can bring 4 degrees of warming over the course of, 70 years, that means we can avert 4 degrees of warming over the course of 70 years because all of the inputs are in our control. The only thing we lack is the will to take action. So I'm hopeful that by raising the alarm, by talking about some of the scarier things that are likely to happen, more people will be motivated to avert them. And there are a lot of reasons, to think we won't be able to take action quickly enough. But I'm hopeful that we'll take action quickly nevertheless and do whatever we can to avert some of the most catastrophic outcomes that are not just imaginable, but quite likely if we keep heading where we're headed.
Well, let's lighten up to the trivial. You wrote in your book about a lot of the burning has happened since the premiere of Seinfeld. And one of my favorite Seinfeld lines comes from Elaine after throwing a valuable fur coat out a window. She says, "I guess I have to buy him a new coat, even though I don't think I should be held responsible, which I am anyway." And I'm sort of applying that argument, perhaps, to the United States. I love the United States. Most of my listeners are in the United States. But the fact is that the great burden of carbon that's been laid out into the atmosphere came from the United States. What do you think about the argument that countries who prospered by filling the sky with carbon should now pay the most to try and avoid this coming catastrophe? Will that ever fly in the U.S.?
The moral logic of it is inarguable. When I think especially about the climate impacts that are already pummeling Saudi Arabia, which has developed over the last few decades largely as an American petro-client state, or what's scheduled to happen in India and Bangladesh, where in India many of the biggest cities are going to become unlivably hot as soon as the middle of this century, and Bangladesh, most of the most populous parts of the country will flood because of climate change by the middle of the century. Those were colonies of Britain, which is the nation that invented the Industrial Revolution, for which we have all this to thank. As I say, I think the moral logic of that perspective is inarguable. How it plays out practically, I don't really know. And I think that's one of the big questions for the coming decades is how do we develop a geopolitics around carbon and around climate change that puts front and center some of these questions, the issues of climate reparation, who will pay for the adaptation measures that are necessary, the mitigation measures that are necessary, who will accommodate the climate refugees, who will bring them into the fold. There are reasons to worry about the answers to those questions. It's hard to start to talk about them because I think we haven't yet developed anything like the geopolitical framework in which they will be answered. If you think about the 20th century, we developed an entire international order around the principle of human rights and peace, and to a lesser extent, perhaps, prosperity powered by market forces, which may not have been as good in the end as it seemed at the time. But coming out of World War II, we really fashioned a whole new global order built on these principles. I think in the 21st century, we're going to see a global order fashioned around the principle of carbon and climate change. What that looks like, who is in charge, who polices, who pays, I don't know. That'll all come out in the wash. But I think we're entering into an entirely new political era, and the answers to these questions will be put forward in that context rather than the one that we've emerging from now, which is one reason why I think the Paris Accords, as noble as they were, as much as I'd like to see them succeed, I think you have to count them at least at this stage as a failure. And that's a sign that the liberal international order that presided, especially since the end of the Cold War, but in ways since the end of World War II, is maybe not up to the task of this challenge. I mean, we'll see. It may rebound. We may have renewed investment and renewed commitment to globalization and the principle of global cooperation. But it is startling to think that while you almost couldn't imagine a threat to the planet bigger or more important than climate change, one that would more naturally call into being the forces of cooperation that were embodied in institutions like the UN and the EU, we're seeing a crisis come about with climate at a time when so many nations of the world, including the U.S., and the UK are retreating from those obligations, are retreating from those organizations, and really having to, assuming a kind of go-it-alone mentality. What that means for where we'll be 10 years from now, I can't say. As someone who is really a child of the end of history in the 90s in America, I want to see those institutions return, but it may be that we have to fashion new ones and new principles to address the scale of the threat that we face.
I totally agree with you, and I've been looking at things like the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the revolution in China, and thinking, well, maybe we will have a climate revolution. And my other thoughts are, you've written that the Paris Climate Accords are looking more and more like a fantasy, and I agree with that for sure. But we are seeing more local action with city mayors aiming for carbon neutral status, and maybe a top-down solution won't be possible, but that doesn't mean we completely fail.
Well, my feeling is that there needs to be some top-down action, that the effort by individuals and even communities, they just don't add up as quickly as they would if they were organized into large-scale political action. So I think that politics on some level has to be the answer. Asking everyone to eat meat out of the goodness of their heart is, and their concern for the planet, I think you're going to get some converts there, but I also think that the numbers are just going to be, the impact is going to be much, much smaller than if you could make some major policy changes that rebuild our choice architecture so that when we are making choices about, say, what to eat or where to travel, that we're doing so in among a buffet of choices, none of which are as irresponsible as the ones that we make today. I think that has to be, that is the role for politics and policy, and there's no other way around it.
So, right, don't take your whole wedding party to Fiji for fun because you're killing the planet. We've got to be able to tell our friends that. So your new book isn't just a summary of climate science. What is the other big story you're trying to tell? You've been giving us a lot of it in this interview, but I think that it's important that you really outline that there's something else in this book that we need.
You know, I'm trying to establish a whole new inquiry into the future of humanity in a time of climate change. So I think of it really as the humanities of climate change. We know the science. We know well enough how it will impact us in terms of what it will mean for hurricanes and what it will mean for droughts and what it will mean for famines. What we really haven't begun to think about is all of the other ways beyond science that it will change our lives, change our orientation towards the planet, change our understanding of our place in history, whether history marks a course of progress or something else. And I really do believe that we're entering into a new era that will be governed by this totally, that will be governed by climate change totally. It will be the meta-narrative of the 21st century, and we won't be able to escape it wherever we look. What that means for our culture, what it means for our child-rearing choices, what it means for our relationship to our phones. All of these are basically unasked questions, but they ultimately are a map of our future on this planet, because whatever climate suffering comes to pass, whatever we do in terms of damaging the planet further and imposing more punishments on our future generations, it will still be the case that there will be humans around living, and they will not be living preoccupied totally by the forces of climate change. They will be preoccupied by the same things that you and I are preoccupied by. The question is, how will climate change affect those concerns? How will it change our orientation? And how will it rebuild our future in ways beyond the narrow impacts of science? And that's the great theme of my book, I think.
We've been talking with David Wallace Wells from New York Magazine. His new book, The Uninhabitable Earth, should be a bestseller about our hotter future. I will put links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much.
Of course, I think it is way past time to panic. Here's a little something from my podcast in December 2005.
2005. Birds disappearing. Large ocean species dying off. Biggest storms ever recorded. Second hottest year on record. Polar ice cap melting. Oceans turning acidic. You know, it's almost time to
panic!
It's the Radio EcoShock Year in Review 2005.
In its year-end review, New Scientist magazine wraps up alarming stories for our times. The biggest North Atlantic tropical storms and hurricanes since records have been kept. A string of major scientists warning we're headed for hell on Earth as the climate shifts unpredictably. And all we get from world leaders is more hot air, while each of us releases tons of new carbon into the world's delicate air supply. Hurricane Katrina was the big climate story, creating a storm surge 6 meters or 18 feet high. But the largest storm ever recorded was Hurricane Wilma, the giant that covered the entire Gulf of Mexico. And don't forget, 2005 was the year when the weather experts ran out of names for storms, reaching into a backup list to add new ones. And this year saw the first hurricane ever seen forming in the South Atlantic, namely Katrina, which struck Brazil in March. Tropical storms from the Americas even reached Spain and Africa. In October 2005, researchers announced that 87% of Antarctic glaciers are now retreating.
ice sheets are melting into the oceans and breaking off in huge chunks, adding to the freshwater levels in the sea. The same was found in the northern Arctic, where reputable scientists reported, for the first time, a measurable shift in the ocean currents that keep Europe habitable. Some experts have warned that global warming will be irreversible without astounding changes in the world's carbon economy within the next 10 years. That's a clip from the Radio EcoShock podcast in 2005. I'll put the whole 11-minute Time to Panic roundup in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Is climate change getting you down? Does it keep you up at night? Artists and academics are trying to express this new dis-ease. And mental health professionals are starting to see a new kind of climate trauma, too. Judith Deutsch is a psychoanalyst with a private practice in Toronto, Canada. Raised and educated in California, Judy has been on the faculty of the Toronto Psychoanalytic Institute. She is a wide-ranging voice for social conscience as past president of Science for Peace, a member of Independent Jewish Voices Canada, respected columnist for Canadian Dimension magazine, and contributor to Counterpunch. Judy Deutsch, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
There's only been very few hard data attempts to study this. A lot of what we know is just what people tell us or write about, but there was one called Empirical Evidence of Mental Health Risks Posed by Climate Change. It was published in October 2018 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And what they did, they got 2 million randomly sampled U.S. residents across a decade of data collection, they say, and they concluded that environmental stressors produced by climate change pose threats to human mental health. Well, you know, for me, Judy, that doesn't tell me much beyond the obvious. What are your feelings about that sort of scientific approach to this?
Well, I think it's very flawed. Questionnaires without having much information about people, you know, the individual people, really doesn't tell you very much. I know that there's quite a lot of, you know, around climate as well as in many other experiences and situations that in one way are catastrophic and disastrous. It doesn't really indicate whether, you know, in a psychological way people are traumatized or not. There's also a lot of complexity in terms of an event like an extreme weather event or these disasters and the kind of, you know, people's personal backgrounds as well as their what's available in their societies. I was thinking about this question, it's something that I've felt very dubious about for quite a long time. And I was thinking about examples from the psychoanalytic experiences, you know, with what appear to be traumatic situations. I was thinking about two that are quite relevant. One is quite early on, was during World War II, during the London Blitz. Anna Freud and several other child analysts set up war nurseries for children who had to leave London because of the tremendous danger of being bombed and so on. And what they did was they tried to maintain family groups and to encourage parents, particularly mothers, to visit these war nurseries, which were located outside of London, as frequently as possible. And that contrasts, for instance, very, very dramatically with the residential school system, which was the opposite. You know, it was taking children away from their society, their families. So you have to look at what are the mediators, the social and institutional ways that traumatic disasters can be dealt with. So you have to look at the, you know, what the society provides. And, you know, in the United States now, the public infrastructure providing help has really so profoundly declined. That's possibly one reason that people are feeling quite helpless. But there are other instances, like during Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, you know, when communities came together and helped each other. So, you know, there's many different ways that disasters can be dealt with.
It's true. You know, I'm thinking of Katrina now. Some of the people there lost their homes, but more than their homes, they lost their community and their whole sense of roots, and they dispersed throughout the United States. They went to Houston and they went to Denver and so on. But others, as you say, sort of gathered together and said, well, let's reimagine New Orleans.
we're going to rebuild this place. And for them, it may have been more positive. I'd like to move on to something that an American professor, E. Ann Kaplan, she wrote a book in 2016 called Climate Trauma. And she was just looking at global warming in movies and literature. And she talked about pre-traumatic stress syndrome. And this sort of clashed with the very little knowledge I have about Freud and the early roots of psychoanalysis, because it seemed to me in those roots, Freud was talking about events that had happened in the past and didn't really envision the possibility of future trauma. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a very good question, because I think that he certainly wrote a lot and did respond to World War I. He actually lost a daughter in the ensuing flu epidemic. So he did write a lot about war and the war and so on. So he was certainly, you know, aware of current trauma. But what he did point out was that people's reactions are very so much influenced by their early experiences, and how their earlier experiences can be reinterpreted at different developmental stages of life, as well as in the context of what they encounter in their society. You know, all these things have a very important bearing on how people experience disaster. And centrally in Freud, too, is how realistic they can be. Do their memories and their fears and their wishes impede their ability to understand what the reality is?
We know some people are prone to depression for whatever reasons, and I'm wondering, do you think that people who are struggling with mental health issues should avoid finding out more about climate change until they feel better?
Again, I think it depends on how it's dealt with, you know, and again, of course, it's one can ask them whether they feel ready to hear about things that are difficult. And also, it's so important to be able to disconfirm what might be a belief that's distorted, you know, by their proclivity to depression and hopelessness. From an analytic point of experience, you know, it could be very helpful to talk with people and to sort out, again, with them, hearing what their worries are when they're ready to talk about them, you know, what is realistic and not. And also what they can do or what they would need, you know, not to feel so hopeless and helpless, too.
Would you talk to us about your article, Convenient Untruths About Human Nature? How does that apply here?
Okay, well, one reason I wrote that is because I, when I was president of Science for Peace, and also I've been involved in these kind of bad and other issues for a while and have participated in many, many different kinds of organizations and groups and stuff. And what I heard so often was that there were assumptions about people that were really incorrect, basically. A lot of truisms, in a way, you know, about human nature. And so often people, you know, spokespeople, very, very sharp people would generalize a lot about we, you know, we do this, and, you know, humans do this, and so on and so forth. And the effect of that was really to prevent really thinking about what the problem was in the first place. In a way, I felt it was really diminishing of people to assume that you can choose what to tell people or not. You know, again, if something is difficult to hear, then you could listen to that and help people with it. But some of these truisms are so common now, you know, like talking about as if consumerism is a basic instinct, as if people can't have a realistic sense of time. They can't see too much in the future. They're living in the present. Or that you can't ask people to give up anything. I think in an even much more insidious and concerning way is the prediction that people will be violent, you know, in the face of particular hardships, like if they're deprived of water and food, you're going to see, or if they need to migrate or storm borders, or they'll fight each other for the last scrap of food and water and that kind of thing. And historically, that's utterly inaccurate. And psychologically, it's also utterly inaccurate, too. So, you know, to describe people as if wars are inevitable, the violence and so on. And again, you know, there's so much historically that shows that there's innumerable ways that people have dealt with these things with each other. I guess, you know, you're thinking about the Nobel Prize to Eleanor Ostrom, you know, who disputed the idea that the commons were disastrous in themselves, the tragedy of the commons, that people will just use up the resources until everything is gone, you know, and that's not what happens. People over and over again organize themselves. Yeah, like, you know, like what happened in Katrina and Sandy. I was talking about the immediate reaction to those events, you know, when people really helped each other.
They did. They brought boats from all over the country to go and try and rescue people, and they brought food and barbecues to get some meat going for those who eat it. Yeah. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Judy Deutsch about climate and mental health. Another thing I've been wondering about is whether there's any rational explanation for why so many climate scientists and other experts still say we have 12 years left to save a good climate, or we can still get 1.5 parts per million CO2 rise, when from everything that I'm reading and the scientists that talk to us, that's no longer possible. So I wonder, are authorities trying to sell us false optimism, or are we demanding that optimism as part of every message that we get? I don't know.
Well, you know, that's also just such a crucial thing to try to figure out, and such an important question and observation. Because I fully agree with you, you know, that this idea of the 12 years and 1.5 degrees, I mean, it's going to be exceeded certainly within a decade, you know, because of amplifying feedback, increasing rate of emissions and so on. But I don't think there's a scientist. I hear this in so many environmental groups and, you know, even the very sharp people, you know, like Naomi Klein and unfortunately, and, you know, the people in the Green New Deal and so on. I think that there's a lot of some fundamental things about the climate systems that just are not explained very clearly to people. I think there's a problem with education, too, you know, the responsibility of universities. But one thing that I from a psychological angle that I think is at work is what happens in groups, you know, that there is, I think, an unwillingness for various reasons, I'm sure, to challenge people who are in positions of authority, to question them. It's interesting because James Hansen in his book, On Terms of My Grandchildren, gave an example of that with when he was a young scientist, Richard Feynman, being the only one who could challenge Niels Bohr because, you know, he was young. He didn't have any big reputation to lose in a way. And Hansen has written about the reticence of scientists. But I think there's a huge problem, and I've observed it so many times with people not challenging people who are in authority, as if there's a culture, you know, of compliance.
Well, we probably need that to some degree for society to function at all. I mean, if everybody's an anarchist, it's very hard to put a society together. And it's ingrained to us in childhood. I mean, you do what your parents tell you.
Well, it can be. I mean, there's been a lot of work on authoritarian versus non-authoritarian families and so on. But it's not anarchism that I'm talking about. It has to do with being informed and being able to question and to challenge on the basis of being informed, you know, of being able to discuss. It's interesting because being able to discuss and argue is also, if I could mention a couple of philosophers, you know, seen as being the most necessary and essential character of democracy. You know, I mean, Thucydides brought that up, and, you know, and his work on the Peloponnesian War, and then, you know, very very recently, Amartya Sen says that discussion and arguing, being informed and so on, is the critical aspect of what makes a democracy, really.
I just missed the name, the second name that you mentioned, the more recent philosopher. Who was that?
It's Amartya Sen, S-E-N, and he wrote a book called The Idea of Justice, which is very, very interesting, what he writes a lot about. It's about people being able to figure out with each other and talk with each other, even young children, in a much more complex way about how to solve problems, you know.
Now, along the ideas of justice, as far as I know, the UN Convention on Refugees and the subsequent international law still does not recognize climate refugees, and we know Donald Trump sure doesn't. So we know rising seas and extreme climate-driven events will set off the greatest mass migrations probably in human history. Do you think governments are waking up? Are we ready at all? Are we psychologically ready for what's coming in that regard?
Well, again, this is so crucial and horrible what the situation is. Right now there's 68 million displaced people, partly due to war, extreme poverty, weather events, and so on. And you're exactly right. The UN does not protect climate refugees, and that's terrible. I think that the rightward swing of governments is going so much in the wrong direction, you know, in a very narrow nationalist, protectionist. I mean, at the end of the Cold War, I think there were 15 walled borders, and now there's 77. And the borders are militarized with, as we know, these awful detention centers. It seems to me that this, again, requires questioning and dealing right now with the whole idea of borders. There's some excellent work on just taking down borders. Personally, I think that that's critical. I mean, you can't have billions of people, you know, without any access to migration, because there's going to be large parts of the world that are uninhabitable. You know, there's sea level rise, there's extreme temperatures. I think on one of your recent programs, maybe, people were talking about that at high temperatures, the wet bulb temperature is unlivable. You know, at 35 degrees wet bulb temperature, you know, people cannot survive, even in the shade, for more than 6 minutes, it said. So.
Well, and I think there's a growing public fear that mass deaths are in our future, even in this century, possibly. And we try to think that, well, people over there will be the ones to die, not our relatively rich selves. There's the concept of disposable people, and there's the problem of if we actually accept that a climate-driven Holocaust is coming, what does that do to us from the psychoanalytic perspective?
So again, this is, I think, related from a psychoanalytic view. It has to do with, I think, what I would call a pathogenic belief. You know, the pathogenic belief being that other people will take what we have, will threaten our lives and so on and so forth. And it doesn't need to be that way at all, you know. And that means, for one, that we have to do everything we can right now to eliminate the threats to life, like eliminate fossil fuel emissions entirely and dismantle the military. I mean, that's, well, we can get into that. But, you know, how does one prepare for taking care of everybody? It's, you know, there's Naomi Klein and others talk about system change. Well, it has to be spelled out what that is going to look like so that everyone is able to survive. I know you had Mike Davis on the program recently, and he's a really brilliant historian who wrote this book about the late Victorian Holocaust, in which up to 50 million people died. But, you know, we can get into that a little bit more. But one of the very fascinating things in the book was that he described a period in the 18th century in China where people were taken care of, you know, in these situations where there was the threat of mass death, that they had prepared for it. They provided the necessities of life. There's other examples that people talk about now, like what happened to Cuba in the 1990s when they lost their entire economy, their fossil fuel-based economy, and had to radically transform their agricultural system so that they could eat, so they could feed their people, you know. And this was done without the disasters that happened in the Soviet Union and in China and in India around their very much failed agricultural transformations, in which, you know, tens of millions of people died and so on. This is all avoidable, you know. If people work together and use the best of their knowledge in figuring out, you know, all these things are avoidable.
You know, I'm thinking about, okay, how are we going to handle this? I feel there's a stress on myself covering this, and I get emails from listeners saying that they feel stressed about it, but there's not going to be enough trained mental health professionals to deal with a tsunami of upset people if the future is very disrupted. I talked with UK psychotherapist Rose Randall about her healing movement called Carbon Conversations. There's circles of people who meet to share their feelings about climate change. Do you think we can help ourselves, Judy, with local climate conversation or support groups?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very important thing there because, you know, a lot of people can be helpful. It's not just trained psychotherapists. In fact, often, you know, trained people also do quite a lot of harm in all these professions. But certainly, yeah, people can be very helpful to each other. Even in medicine, I recently met and read the book by Gretchen Rohde. I think that's how you pronounce her name, but she's a physician who has worked for decades, you know, partly with Médecins Sans Frontières, but other groups too, in horrible conditions around the world. And you know what paraprofessional people are now able to do? Like, you don't have to be a doctor now to do brain surgery, you know? I mean, there's incredible things that people can learn how to do. They're doing it. I mean, it's already been the news. And, you know, you have this whole tradition, too, of course, like with nurse midwives, you know, being in charge of dealing with pregnancy and childbirth and so on. So you don't have to be trained professionals for many, many years and so on to be helpful.
I remember back in college, sort of psychology 101, reading about a double bind theory, and I think that may apply to the situation we're in now because we know we're damaging the climate every day by driving cars, by the way our food system works, everything. And yet we have to keep on doing it because we depend on that for our survival, we think. That sounds pretty familiar, too, to people with other damaging personal behaviors that they can't control. Should we be talking about carbon addiction, for example?
For some reason, and I do think it has to do with the irresponsibility of people who are in positions of influence. And I here, you know, include, you know, people in city councils and universities and so on and so forth. They've reneged on their responsibility. I go to the gym at the University of Toronto, and I see everyone, you know, pushing buttons to instead of walking through a turnstile, you know, to get into the gym. And it's not like that's going to admit very much, but it's as if nothing is on their mind, you know, about using excess electrical energy, you know, or for a brief time, plastic bags cost a few cents. So nobody used plastic bags. And then somehow that got overturned into everybody's using plastic bags. It's very bizarre. But I feel concerned that when the solutions that are proffered are so out of sync with the magnitude of the problem, that it creates a lot of doubt and skepticism in people about how serious the problem really is. And that's been the case all along, you know, that the proffered solutions have been so disproportionate to what the problem is. Certainly there are efforts to address aspects of it, like there's a free public transit movement here in Toronto, but there has to be so much more of that. It's so easy to sidetrack what the full picture is. You know, in terms of ignorance, in 2009, it was before the Copenhagen meetings, when I was president of Science for Peace, we were fortunate enough to have James Hansen come and talk. We did it in collaboration with the Center for Global Change Science, and we brought together for the first time James Hansen, Naomi Klein, and Clayton Thomas Mueller from the Indigenous Environmental Network. He's a tar sands campaigner. So what I was wanting to do was to bring together these intersecting aspects having to do with climate change and climate justice, and you know the system, the capitalistic system too. So James Hansen had just written his book, it was just published, The Storm of My Grandchildren, which to my mind It's a fascinating book, and I think it's an essential book. He's such a brilliant scientist, and I think demonstrates what scientific thinking, like his way of questioning and observing things in the physical world. I don't think he's very good in terms of politics, but his scientific work is so important. Anyway, the University of Toronto has one of the largest university libraries in North America. So I noticed it took quite a long time for them to even get one copy of his book. Now, after 10 years, there's only two copies of his book in the entire University of Toronto system, whereas there's multiple copies of other people who are essentially climate skeptics, or they befuddle the whole thing, like Bjorn Lomborg. So, he'll have 10 to 20 copies in the library, whereas there's only two. So I taught a class there for a couple of years on climate justice, and the students told me, that it was hardly ever talked about. This is a subject that should be, that all departments should be working on it, and working together. It's hard to understand. In the class that I taught, the students talked about it, and they said that, it's more of like a cultural, there's an aspect of cultural style. They said that in their social groups, you're not supposed to talk about anything that's stressful, But however, if you do something, then you'll be imitated and copied, but you're not supposed to talk about it. Like they implemented recycling and composting and all that kind of stuff. And then everybody did it, but they weren't willing to talk about it. So this is a particular culture amongst these students and an educated, affluent aspect, a little group, but it's hard to know. A couple of years ago, I was in Guatemala, too, as part of a health delegation to look at the impact of mining on the people. And there were people from Guatemala, Panama, southern part of Mexico. And they were just completely straightforward and forthcoming about what was going on and its psychological social impact, young people too, and they were talking about climate change. So, again, it's hard to make generalizations about why and how these things happen. But from an analytic point of view, psychoanalytic, really, I think quite central in Freud was addressing the capacity to deal with reality, to perceive reality, to act in accordance with reality. And there's the inside reality, the psychological world, and then there's the outside. And what he helped people with is to disentangle, again, their fears and their wishes from what the realities are. And what you do is you help people. If it feels like it's too overwhelming, then you can talk with them about what aspect is overwhelming and what can be done. Maybe it is too overwhelming and there's nothing, but often there is. And any groups are people who are able to think through and try to figure out what to do. Like you're talking about buying and cars and all that kind of stuff. So then, these are things that have to change. So you say, how can we do that? What's the best way that we can do that? What are the different possibilities rather than avoiding the whole thing altogether?
And as we wrap up here, Judy, do you have people or places beyond what you've already mentioned? You mentioned some great stuff to recommend for our listeners who want to learn more.
I would recommend three people in particular. I had mentioned the Mike Davis book, Late Victorian Holocaust, is very important. But also Andreas Malm, M-A-L-M, is excellent. And Jason Moore. And there's two French people who've written a book together that's really superb. It's called The Shock of the Anthropocene by Benoit and Verso. It's published by Verso, and these are just excellent, very, very carefully researched histories that disprove for many of the assumptions that I think have been paralyzing in terms of trying to figure out what to do.
The Shock of the Anthropocene, and this is Radio EcoShock, as it turns out, and I'm going to put links to pretty well everything we've talked about and some more helpful links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I want to mention things like climatepsychologyalliance.org, which has got a whole bunch of things going on. There's speakers coming up in London with Jem Bendel and Ro Randall in April 2019. That sort of thing you can find out. I'll put it in my blog. Check that out for sure. From Toronto, Canada, we've been talking with practicing psychoanalyst, journalist, and activist Judy Deutsch. Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
We ran out of time on that one, but you can listen to or download my full 49-minute interview with Judy Deutsch from my website at ecoshock.org. Next week, we're back to more shocking climate science from some of the best in the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
It's that evangelical Pentecostal influence that provides a real basis for the kind of right-wing, pro-American, pro-NATO, and pro-Israel government that Bolsonaro represents. And that is not present in Venezuela. It's not present at all in a place like Nicaragua or in Mexico. That's a really interesting factor here, is the evangelical Christian right influence.
That's very interesting. Max, in the 1980s, there was quite a long, there were many instances of the Israeli government pouring arms into Latin America, even in times when the Israeli government wasn't led by the Israeli right, it was led by the so-called Labour Party or its related parties. That, you know, they're arms going to all sorts of death squads and sort of fascist or semi-fascist governments in Latin America. And that's, I mean, that's something you've written about somewhat. Have you seen any evidence or indication of anything like that happening now in Latin America?
Well, you wrote about it recently, Asa, but it was in Ukraine. Where Congress for the first time implemented or voted for a restriction in the defense authorization bill to the Azov Battalion, which is an ideologically fascist, I would say neo-Nazi National Guard unit. It was a militia that's been officially incorporated into the Ukrainian National Guard and started to receive U.S. weapons. And so Congress, led by Representative Ro Khanna, who, by the way, is the only elected official I can think of in the U.S. who's condemned the coup in Venezuela so far. No word from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or these new self-styled socialists yet. Mm. But they imposed this restriction on arming the Azov Battalion. And the next thing you know, you see the light weapon of choice becoming the Tavor rifle, which, you know, if you've been to the West Bank and gone through a checkpoint, you're going to see soldiers standing there with Tavor rifles. Now you look at the Azov propaganda videos that show them training, and they're all carrying Tavor rifles. Israel's always been kind of used as sort of a proxy to get around restrictions imposed by Congress on the Defense Department. And that's what took place in the 1980s, particularly in Guatemala, after the Boland Amendment was passed. This is, you know, a really interesting period in American politics, the late 70s, early 80s, because you had all these revelations of intelligence scandals and these blood-soaked assassination programs run through the CIA, like the Phoenix program, where there was actually a goal, quotas were set of how many Vietnamese communist cadres the American death squads would kill. This all came out in the 70s thanks to you know, reporters like Cy Hirsch. It came out in the 80s thanks to reporters like Robert Parry, the late Robert Parry. And, you know, Congress actually started imposing restrictions on the so-called intelligence community, something that would be unthinkable today. One of those restrictions was the Boland Amendment, where they said that, you know, if you want to do covert action, if the U.S. wants to do covert action, the executive, the president has to officially sign off on it so we can hold him accountable. Because Reagan was up there talking about Iran-Contra and saying, well, I do not recall. I don't know anything about this. I'm, you know, Colonel North may know more, but I have nothing. My hands are clean. So that was passed. So what does the U.S. do? It turns to its contacts in Israel to arm Ephraim Rios-Montt, who was this very Bolsonaro-like fascistic dictator who was a right-wing evangelical Pentecostal. His pastor was actually an American Pentecostal, and he was waging basically a genocide against the Mayan population of Guatemala, but also trying to smash this leftist insurgency that had been going on since the 70s. Israel not only brings in Uzis and other light weapons, it brings in trainers. And the people who trained Rios-Montt's army were Israeli officers. He said our model is the Israeli soldier, and they really learned the Israeli counterinsurgency campaigns, that tactics that had been perfected in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip, since 1967. That, I think, you know, deserves more study, but there are a lot of good studies. There's a decent pamphlet out there by the the International Network of Anti-Zionists.
International Jewish Anti-Zionist
Network.
Yeah, they did a pamphlet on Israel's role in atrocities worldwide, starting with Guatemala. Right now in Latin America, you know, Israel has the closest relationship it has is with Colombia, and that really just goes to like supplying them with, you know, communications gear, surveillance equipment, and weapons, as well as just mutual political support. And, you know, Colombia has cultivated those ties since its government and its right-wing militias were waging war against, you know, leftist guerrillas in the rural areas, in one of the bloodiest civil wars. Right now, I mean, it's not ongoing. The peace process is still taking place, but they now have a really close relationship with Israel. Really, I see Israel as, you know, benefiting from these ties with figures like Bolsonaro through the U.S. And it's just, I kind of look at it as kind of a transatlantic or global alliance against progressive governments.
Mm. It's interesting how you mention AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the new sort of wave of, I guess we could say, progressive Democrats, or, you know, democratic socialists, members of the Democratic Socialist Alliance in Congress. I guess it's literally today that we're talking about this happening in Venezuela, so I guess we should sort of wait and see. But what they say, if anything, I mean, I guess the fact they haven't said anything yet is not a good early indication. And it kind of speaks to the limitations of these kinds of democratic socialist parties, or trying to reclaim these sort of mainstream political parties in a way. And we see, I think we see similar limitations here in the Labour Party, where, I mean, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's international policy positions are far better than Bernie Sanders's. But unfortunately, there's far too many people in the Labour Party at all levels, I think we can say, who are far too willing to sort of let international, you know, what's called foreign policy, put it on the back burner and just sort of say, okay, we'll just give that up. And so we can get through our domestic agenda, you know, in this country, renationalizing the railways and stopping the privatization of NHS and things like that. And then maybe later we'll move on. Palestine is obviously the kind of emblematic issue of that in a lot of ways, or it's kind of a litmus test, really. And this whole thing, to me, with the Integrity Initiative, is quite telling in terms of people's attitudes within the Labour Party. So I've been catching up with some of your reporting on this, Max, And in some ways, it's quite a complicated story, but in other ways, it's fairly simple. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what is the Integrity Initiative and give us the sort of broad outlines of your recent reporting on it. And then maybe afterwards, we could talk a little bit about what, if any, implications there are for Palestine. So just sort of take us through what you're reporting on it.
Well, you provoked so many thoughts with what you just said about the limitations of for sort of self-styled progressive lawmakers in the UK and the US when it comes to actually forcefully challenging Western foreign policy and just the whole concept of empire. And I've noticed there's sort of an uptick in accusations that Bernie Sanders is a Russian plant. It's obvious, patently ridiculous. Tulsi Gabbard, who is a member of Congress who's actually stuck her neck out on some really critical foreign policy issues. I wonder where she'll come down on Venezuela, and I really think she needs to make an expansive foreign policy speech soon to lay out.
If Bernie Sanders is a Russian plant, they'd be working on that one for decades, right? How old is he? He's like, yeah. What is he, in his late 70s? Yeah.
Well, he took a trip to the Soviet
Union.
The
long con, right.
Yeah, he took a trip to the Soviet Union, and you know, he wrote a letter supportive of the Sandinistas to Daniel Ortega, who's now persona non grata in Washington. And the Clinton sort of attack machine had compiled all this but didn't deploy it because they were able to easily fix the primary process, so they didn't need to do it. But, you know, they're still out there, and I'm not sure who they're going to support, but they don't want Bernie Sanders to win. They don't like Tulsi Gabbard being out there talking about foreign policy. It's not just the Clintonites. It's like there are much more powerful elements that are part of what I would consider to be a permanent state. And that's what we're talking about with the Integrity Initiative. But, you know, I mean, there was a documentary called Active Measures, which is about Russiagate and how Trump is, you know, secretly controlled by Putin. And it's actually made by the son of this hedge funder who is the boyfriend of Anna Wintour, who used to, I think, publish Vanity Fair and is very close to Hillary Clinton. And it features Hillary Clinton in the documentary, along with all of these people in her inner circle and a bunch of spooks, current and former, just talking about Trump, Putin. And this documentary's Twitter account recently tweeted that Bernie Sanders is controlled by the Kremlin. And that really was ominous to me. It suggested that. And then there was this other woman who worked for a pro-Clinton super PAC who's trying to raise money to have, like, her name is Caroline Orr, to have like a Hawaiian vacation / investigate Tulsi Gabbard for Russian ties. And this is just, you know, Russiagate has become, as I said from the beginning, as soon as it was rolled out, I said it's going to blow back on the left and it's going to be used to suppress left-wing activity and to intimidate progressives. And it's happened. It's really successful. Obviously, it's a very American phenomenon that goes back to the Cold War, but there's been a clear effort to export it to the UK. And the UK has played a big role in Russiagate from the beginning through all of these figures who most Americans know very little about but are connected to the MI5, MI6. Christopher Steele, of course, the author of the Dodgy dossier, the Steele dossier, which became sort of the basis for Russiagate. The production of it was funded by Perkins Coie, a law firm connected to Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC. Then it was, you know, James Comey attempted to pay for it when he was the FBI director to continue this, you know, private ex-MI6 spooks investigation of Trump for Russian ties. It was used against Jill Stein as well. And then you had, you know, Christopher Steele's associate at Orbis, which is the private intelligence firm that he runs, Pablo Miller, being very much wrapped up in the Skripal scandal, where, you know, Sergei Skripal, who was a former British spy who was jailed in Russia, who used to be a Russian spy, was poisoned in Salisbury in England along with his daughter. and nobody knows who did it. Everyone's pointing the finger at Russia, although it doesn't quite make sense because it happened right before the World Cup in Moscow while Putin's on a charm offensive, and it's used in the UK to stir up Russiagate fever. And Pablo Miller, who's a former MI6 operative, happens to be Sergei Skripal's handler, was living basically next door to him in Salisbury while he's working with Christopher Steele, who helped spawn Russiagate in the U.S. And Pablo Miller's name is put under a D notice in the U.K. What's a D notice? It means that you, as a member of the media in the U.K., are legally forbidden from writing his name or publishing his name. That's extremely unusual. In Israel, they have that. You know, the military censor will tell you you can't.
Right.
Anat Kam, I don't know if you remember her, the military whistleblower, the Israeli press couldn't publish her name. This is highly unusual. And now Pablo Miller turns up in the UK cluster of the Integrity Initiative. He's named in that. So now we have to kind of step back and talk about what the Integrity Initiative is and why all of these names and all of this matters and why your eyes shouldn't kind of glaze over while I talk. You know, if you want to understand not just Russiagate, but how our media is really acting as kind of an arm of the permanent national security state, both in the UK and the US, you have to understand the Integrity Initiative scandal. And it started when the email servers of a think tank that none of us had heard of previously called the Institute for Statecraft were hacked in November. The documents that came out started floating around online through a, you know, anonymous Europe, which for all I know could be Russian hackers. And what these documents showed was the existence of something called the Integrity Initiative, which was covertly funded to the tune of over $2 million by the British Foreign Office, which oversees GCHQ, which is the British version of the NSA, and MI6, the foreign intelligence arm of the British government, to basically run a propaganda campaign to convince not just the British public, but the public across Europe and now in the US that our societies, our countries need to be on a permanent war footing against Russia, and that Russian active measures, which include the broadcasting of UK and Sputnik, pretty much anything Russian, are acts of war that must be responded to with other acts of war, basically an information war. You know, it's really difficult for the US to do to Russia what it did to Iraq or Libya. Russia has a very strong conventional army, same with China. So what we're fighting is an information war overseen by figures who come out of the military and intelligence services. And that's who was in charge at the Institute for Statecraft. This think tank, which was posing as an independent charity, was actually run by people from the British military intelligence apparatus. And what they did was they created these clusters of influencers across the West, many of whom were journalists, and they would have conferences of journalists where they would basically not necessarily give them their marching orders, but instill in them the narrative and then promote people, you know, with this British government money, like someone you know well, Asa, Carol Cadwallader at The Guardian, who's been saying that Russia is behind Brexit. Russian bots are the reason that Brexit passed. And, you know, in November, the Integrity Initiative held an event at the Frontline Club that I didn't know about because it wasn't listed on the Frontline Club's website. I only found out about it through these hacked documents. But it had all of these major journalists from the Times of London, which is like the favorite paper of the MI5. James Ball, the former WikiLeaks guy who's now at The Guardian, and his basically his job, you know, he's just a professional Assange basher. And Carol Cadwallader, who I mentioned. And so these journalists are mixing it up with these military intelligence apparatchiks who are fanatics. They're absolute fanatics. Chris Donnelly, who's the head of the Integrity Initiative, had actually published a white paper calling for NATO to mine the harbor of Sevastopol during the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis, which would have caused a shooting war with Russia. You know, he believes that we should be in some form of war with Russia, a nuclear power. It's very terrifying, especially if you live in Europe and you're in that sphere of influence. And there are these clusters across the West. I mean, in pretty much every NATO member state. And in the UK, what wound up happening was the Integrity Initiative's Twitter account was promoting all of these attacks on Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party. And then when it emerges that this Twitter account and this organization is actually funded by the Tory government, you start to understand that this is kind of a coup taking place, a very British coup taking place against Jeremy Corbyn. I think the most principled progressive leader in the West who has a hope of, you know, taking leadership of a major Western country. And it's being run out of a group funded by the British government, run by the military intelligence apparatus with close ties to the media.
The Electronic Intifada.
This edition of the Electronic Intifada podcast will be continued next week.
Intifada al Electronia.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Scott X. Esdale, member of the NAACP National Board of Directors, who examines the recent arrest of a Coast Guard lieutenant accused of plotting to assassinate Democratic Party leaders and media personalities to further his white supremacist ideology. Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper, who talks about anti-government protests in Haiti linked with corruption charges surrounding funds embezzled or misspent from Venezuela's Petrocaribe oil discount program. And Roger Geller, Portland, Oregon's bicycle program manager, who discusses the advances his city has made in expanding bike ridership and the benefits for the community and environment. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the early days of the Trump administration, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pushed a plan to build dozens of nuclear power plants in Saudi Arabia in possible violation of the Atomic Energy Act, which requires congressional approval of nuclear exports. Flynn resigned and later pled guilty to lying to the FBI and cooperated with the Mueller investigation into his communications with Russian officials. Before joining the Trump administration, Flynn had worked with energy interests seeking to build nuclear power plants in the Persian Gulf. A report by the House Oversight and Reform Committee called for further investigation into a possible Saudi nuclear deal and conflicts of interest with the Trump family and close allies. Key players beyond Flynn included his deputy Derek Harvey and Tom Barrack, a top Trump fundraiser who raised $7 million from investors in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Details of the Saudi nuclear scheme were exposed in 2017 by ProPublica. One of the companies that would profit from a U.S.-Saudi nuclear deal would be Westinghouse Electric, now owned by Brookfield Asset Management, which bailed out a Manhattan building project owned by the Kushner family. Despite resistance from some national security officials, momentum is building for a Saudi nuclear deal. However, after the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi officials, Congress is reluctant to agree to a transfer of nuclear technology to the Saudi kingdom. Hedge fund investors won a round in the ongoing battle over Puerto Rico's massive debt. The American Prospect reports that a U.S. federal court approved a plan that locks in 40 years of extremely generous government payments on sales tax-backed bonds, the island's largest pool of debt. The deal will saddle the island with a regressive 11.5% sales tax, higher than any state in the U.S. Critics have long complained that the process to restructure Puerto Rico's debt only reinforces the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico's colonial status, giving power over the island's future to an unelected federal financial oversight board. Now a U.S. court has rubber-stamped the deal with no participation from Puerto Rico's residents. The restructuring plan for what is known as COFINA debt carries grave consequences for the vast majority of Puerto Ricans, money that could be funding health care, education, and a just recovery from 2017's hurricanes and a 13-year economic depression, will instead pad the pockets of hedge fund billionaires and their wealthy investors. Opposition to this unjust debt plan is growing, and with it, international solidarity is likely to grow too. California's newly sworn-in Governor Gavin Newsom promised a Marshall Plan for housing, and in his proposed state budget asked that $1.75 billion be dedicated to alleviating the housing shortage. Housing advocates praised the new commitment, noting that former Governor Jerry Brown had failed to address the affordable housing crisis. Foundations and major tech companies are pledging to invest in new low-income housing in the Bay Area, where gentrification has decimated working-class communities. The Partnership for the Bay's Future plans over the next decade to build 8,000 low-income apartments and preserve 175,000 affordable housing units. California has an estimated shortage of 1.5 million units of affordable housing. More than 3 million tenants statewide spend more than one-third of their annual income on rent. Last fall's Proposition 10 would have allowed local governments to expand rent control. It was fiercely opposed by developers and private equity investors like Blackstone, which had purchased large numbers of foreclosed homes after the housing collapse a decade ago. In the aftermath of the defeat of Proposition 10, progressive housing activists are looking for new strategies to strengthen tenant rights. These activists are now looking to team up with unions to put pressure on private equity companies and institutions like universities and hospitals, which are often the drivers of gentrification and the destruction of affordable housing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
A U.S. Coast Guard lieutenant and self-identified white nationalist was arrested last week on weapons and drug charges related to a terrorist attack he had been plotting. The 49-year-old resident of Silver Spring, Maryland, is accused of stockpiling weapons and ammunition in order to carry out assassinations against a list of journalists and Democratic Party political leaders he had compiled. The man's ultimate goal, in his own words, was to establish a white homeland. Among those targeted for assassination were House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Richard Blumenthal, along with U.S. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Maxine Waters, and former House member Beto O'Rourke. Also included on the terrorist hit list were MSNBC hosts Chris Hayes and Joe Scarborough, as well as Don Lemon and Van Jones from CNN. Your reporter spoke with Scott X. Estale, member of the NAACP National Board of Directors, and president of the NAACP Connecticut State Conference. Here, Estale examines the arrest of the Coast Guard lieutenant plotting domestic terrorism and what he says is the urgent need for Congress to open hearings on the rise of white supremacist hate groups coinciding with the Trump campaign and presidency.
We've been seeing this backlash ever since President Obama's first run for presidency. Ever since he won that election, there's been a strong backlash to African Americans across the nation. It started pretty much with the Tea Party, and then that particular climate has escalated into Donald Trump winning in the White House after President Obama. Since he's been in office, he's really been throwing gas on the fire, striving to increase the tension nationwide. It's interesting with this particular arrest for this Coast Guard, who was actually a lieutenant. He was a high-ranking officer. Obviously insane in reference to striving to create a race war here in the United States, creating a beachhead for all whites in America. If the government does not take this serious, this will continue to increase, people will, get very, very upset and start getting into their own corners, and the tension will rise. And then, we're going to start seeing physical fights in the streets. And I think it's imperative that the leaders of government and our government officials should take this serious. But now what we're seeing is that the government is monitoring black activists that are out here protesting, and the national NAACP at our headquarters is calling for hearings before the Homeland Security and also before the National Judiciary Committee to try to calm this stuff down going on around the country and get the government to work for the people and strive to stop this violence instead of pouring gasoline on it and enhancing this climate.
As you just said, the NAACP is calling for the House Judiciary Committee and the House Committee on Homeland Security to conduct hearings on domestic terrorism and the threats of white supremacist violent organizations. What can the Congress do? What can the federal government do to push back against these violent organizations that preach hate?
Well, it's their job to protect and serve. It's their job to arrest people and put people like this, a lieutenant, away. If you keep being passive and letting this racism run rampant around America, bad things are going to happen, just like bad things have happened in the past. We found in the KKK years ago, it was high-ranking public officials that were a part of these organizations. And that's why they had to wear hoods over their head, because at night they were terrorists and during the day they were public officials. Now we're seeing lieutenants, they're supposed to be guarding, protecting our nation, and they're actually trying to create the war in our nation. So it's very hypocritical. We're asking the government, to take this thing serious and lock these people up and put them away, because they know who these people are. They should know who they are, and they need to take it more serious instead of monitoring the people that are using their constitutional rights to protest and strive to call America on the bad things that are going on in reference to police officers killing unarmed people in America. They should be arresting these hate groups like the White Wolves and the neo-Nazis and the skinheads and the KKK that are rearing their ugly heads back as if they were still back in the mid-1800s and the early 1900s.
And the other part of the call that the NAACP has made, again, as you mentioned, the NAACP is calling for more transparency about government agencies that are using methods to track and monitor black activists, like many tens of thousands of people who've rallied against police brutality and police violence under many banners, including the Black Lives Matter banner. Tell us a bit about what it is that Congress can do to expose some of these extra-constitutional surveillance programs that are targeting activists.
Well, they need to stop. That's what they need to do. The government needs to stop monitoring people that are exercising their constitutional rights. And they need to be putting away the bad guys, not the good guys. And that's the number one thing that the government needs to do. And they need to do it immediately, swiftly, and decisively, and stop playing games. We've learned about the counterintelligence program of the 60s and the 70s, and it seems like the government is still carrying out these same type of practices and tactics. And it's imperative that the government, meaning the Judiciary Committee, do a full-fledged investigation on this crisis, and also Homeland Security in reference to protecting us at home and making sure that we're safe at home and not being targeted and zeroed in on in reference to what this guy was doing. Once again, a high-ranking official was a lieutenant, and striving to start a race war at the same time.
That was Scott X. Esdale, member of the NAACP National Board of Directors and president of the NAACP Connecticut State Conference. Find more commentary and analysis on the rise of racist hate groups across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thousands of anti-government protesters took to the streets across Haiti beginning February 7th. Where clashes with police left 9 dead and dozens injured. Haitians angry about rising prices, high inflation, unemployment, and corruption charges against President Jovenel Moïse have demanded he step down. Protesters attacked the presidential palace and attempted to block access to the capital's airport. During the unrest, Haitian police detained 5 U.S. citizens and 2 Serbians who were carrying heavy weapons in unmarked vehicles. The Haitian government later released the group, which included military veterans and mercenaries, allowing them to return to the U.S. without charges. This fueled suspicions across Haiti that the men were part of a covert operation gone wrong. Your reporter spoke with Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper, who talks about the current anti-government protests in Haiti that are linked with corruption charges surrounding funds embezzled or misspent from Venezuela's Petrocaribe oil discount program. Savings for the program were slated to be invested in social programs for the poor after Haiti was devastated by the 2010 earthquake.
The principal call has become for Jovenel Moïse to step down. It has really morphed into that since the protests began last summer, demanding what happened to the $4 billion of Venezuela petrodollars, which Haiti benefited from over the last decade. To step back, I guess we need to do a little historical review. These demonstrations today are very similar to what happened 33 years ago when Jean-Claude Duvalier left. He was the second of 2 so-called presidents for life. His father, François Papadoc Duvalier, died in 71 and passed a title and dictatorship on to his son. And basically for 3 decades, for 30 years, from 1957 to 86, they ruled Haiti with an iron fist. And a lot of resentment and anger grew and exploded finally in November of 1985, but Jean-Claude had to flee the country on a U.S.-supplied Air Force plane with his fast cars and his wife's Minx and went to a golden exile in France. But that was really the beginning of 5 years of very tumultuous government instability, demonstrations in the street, and the result was in 1990, December 1990, the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, an anti-imperialist liberation theology priest. The Haitians underwent a coup d'etat for that and for Aristide's re-election in 2000, a second coup d'etat, both followed by foreign military occupations by the United Nations. Nonetheless, the victory of December 16, 1990, really marked the kickoff of what was the pink tide in Latin America, because following Haiti's example, Hugo Chavez, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa, Lugo, a number of other progressive and even revolutionary presidents came to power. We could even include Lula in Brazil in that category. The Venezuelan government, as your listeners surely know, also had a coup d'etat against it in 2002, against Hugo Chavez, which the Venezuelan people turned back, also thanks in large measure to the intervention of the rank and file of the Venezuelan army. Chavez really realized that they were going to just keep coming for him and said, we have to build bridges. We have to help these other countries to come and join us in building 21st century socialism in Latin America. And so he began a program called the Petrocaribe program, whereby he would give nations cheap oil, great credit, and thereby help them in a period when oil was selling for $100 a barrel. Haiti signed on to this deal in 2006. It took them 2 years to really get everything in place because of the resistance of the U.S. Embassy and the State Department, who were fighting them behind the scenes every step of the way. And through a lot of different maneuvers, they managed to get into power a neo-Duvalierist president, a guy called Michel Martelly. Anyway, Martelly came in, and for the 5 years that he was in office, the majority of this Petrocaribe fund was plundered. And it was about $4 billion worth of petrodollars, which were generated. Some of those were paid to Venezuela, but many of them went into this Petrocaribe fund. And 2 Senate investigations found that at least $2 million of it was embezzled, stolen, misspent, just plain lost in some cases. Jovenel Moise, who is the current president, had an agribusiness, was basically a shell company, a fake business. He was laundering millions of dollars through this agribusiness firm that came into office indicted for that money laundering. He had his agribusiness being given millions of dollars to fix a road and do other infrastructure work, none of which he did. On January 10th, 2019, the Jovenel Moise government voted to stick a knife in the back of the Venezuelans, and they voted with Washington saying that Nicolas Maduro was illegitimate. Here's a guy who came into power with only 19% of the electorate taking part in the election, and it was a very controversial election, and he's calling Nicolas Maduro, who won close to 70% of the vote in his country, even with opposition members in it, in that vote. So the people were just said, that's it, we're going out. And hence, on February 7th, which is the anniversary of Jean-Claude's departure 33 years ago, they came out in the streets, and that began basically 10 days of what they called Haiti Lock. Haiti was locked down. Nothing was working. Schools, stores, streets, everything was stop, 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 burning barricades everywhere. The country was in flames. The rebellion has taken what they're saying a little break. They're getting a little breath. Carnival is next week on March 5th, but it is an extremely combustible situation. And right after Carnival, or maybe when the second part of the accounting court report comes out in April, this thing is going to flare up, and maybe that may be the end. I think Jovenel is on extremely thin ice.
That was Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper. For more news and information on the anti-government protests in Haiti, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Commuting by bicycle is growing around the country, nowhere more than in Portland, Oregon, which has the largest bike mode split of any major U.S. city. As of 2014, 7.2% of commuters were biking to work in Portland, where in most cities it's under 1%. In November, the Portland City Council approved a plan to build just under 17 miles of protected bike paths throughout the downtown area. The plan includes the step of eliminating 1,000 parking spaces and more than 13 miles of car lanes. The protected bike lanes are expected to attract even more city residents to leave their cars and hop onto bikes. The Portland Bureau of Transportation's bicycle program manager, Roger Geller, who's held that job for the past two decades, is deeply involved in transportation design, policy, and planning. At a recent event sponsored by Bike Walk Connecticut, Geller spoke about the progress his city has made, how much more can be accomplished, and the benefits of biking for the community and the environment. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the event and brings us excerpts of Geller's talk.
So we all talk about how increasing bicycling is going to benefit our communities, how it can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, about how it can improve our economies, and improve our personal and public health. We talk about how bicycling can help create equitable outcomes by reducing the household economic burden of transportation. We always talk about the potential of bicycling to accomplish these things and more. We talk about the potential because few locales in North America have realized these benefits with sufficient breadth and depth to quantitatively talk about the reality of what bicycling can deliver. So I'm here tonight to tell you that Portland, Oregon provides that measurable U.S. example of how bicycling provides these benefits. In Portland, we have measured how bicycling provides an economic benefit. We've measured how bicycling limits automobile use and provides all the benefits that come with that. And I'm here to tell you how we did that, what we accomplished, how, in retrospect, we've invested very little in doing that, and how we're going to be moving forward. What we've managed to do in Portland over the past 40 years, you can do it in your cities, and at a much faster pace. As an American city, Portland has always loved our automobiles. We didn't have anything resembling a bikeway network. We didn't have bicycling rates above the 1% or fewer of the strong and fearless riders. Yet we managed to change that curve, and it was largely the result of political leadership. Earl Blumenauer, now a U.S. representative from Oregon's 3rd District, was formerly a Portland city commissioner. Transportation was in his portfolio. In the 1970s and 80s, he understood the benefits of bicycling. And when, in the late 1980s, he assumed his position in city government, he worked to adopt the progressive bicycle transportation policy to make bicycling a part of daily life in Portland. In subsequent years, he was followed by Sam Adams, who was our mayor, and Steve Novick, who was a Portland commissioner. All of these political leaders understood the benefits of bicycling. They experienced it personally. They recognized that it provided benefit to the city. They all dedicated resources to developing bike infrastructure. They all provided political support for the inevitable trade-offs that come when you're trying to carve space out of the roadway for bike infrastructure. So political leadership, I've come to realize, is absolutely critical when a jurisdiction is advancing bicycle transportation. So what do you do when you have once you have political leadership? The most important thing and the thing that Portland has done is to build a bikeway network. It's rightfully a foundation of increasing bicycle use. It's the growth in miles and quality of Portland's bikeway network that's led directly to our success in increasing bike use. This is where we began 40 years ago. We had about 31 miles of bikeways. We started slowly. We had 77 miles by 1990. We didn't really pick up steam until the mid to late 1990s. And we built mostly standard bicycle lanes. Over time, as we've been learning more, we've been working to improve the quality of our bikeways, going from standard lanes to buffered lanes to protected lanes. Those improvements didn't come until much later, and we're still working on those. Most of our network is and remains conventional bike lanes. 38 years after that first slide, this is where we are today. We've got a bikeway network of about 373 miles. Political leadership being key, political leaders who want to advance bicycling, they need talking points. And this is really the first talking point I want to leave you, that more than 50% of Portland commuters live in areas where the average bicycle mode split is more than 10%. Even more interesting is this area. So you have almost 30% of Portland commuters. That's about 100,000 Portland commuters, not residents, just commuters, people who are driving to work. And the bike mode split in that area is approaching 14%. It's on a par with transit, and Portland has an excellent transit system. In the heart of Portland, about 14% bike mode split. So very good for America. It puts us on par with kind of a low-performing suburb of Amsterdam. It's really good. I don't want to belittle it. But what I hope you get from the way I'm presenting this is we're not satisfied. We're not at all satisfied. We have such great potential, as do all of our cities in the U.S., if we just invest. You get what you pay for. You get what you invest into.
That was Portland, Oregon's Bureau of Transportation Bicycle Program Manager, Roger Geller. Learn more about Portland's innovative and successful bike program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
When the oppressed support the oppressed. In recent weeks, prominent black leaders have been labeled quite unjustly with a tag of anti-Semitism. The best known is perhaps the iconic radical figure Dr. Angela Y. Davis and the brilliant young scholar and author Dr. Mark Lamont Hill. As a direct result of these charges, Davis had an award from a Birmingham, Alabama civil rights group rescinded, and Hill was fired from his post at CNN. At bottom, both were attacked for daring to speak out publicly on behalf of Palestinians and the stark denial of their human rights under Israeli occupation, which raises the obvious question: who has the right to tell one oppressed people when or whether they may support another oppressed people? Few can question the oppression laid upon blacks for centuries in America, which has repercussions into the present that are far too numerous to recount here. Few can honestly question the social deprivation suffered by the Palestinians since the foundation of Israel in 1948, from land confiscations, mass incarceration, and military occupation over Arab villages and communities, and more. Why and how does it become anti-Semitism when communities of the oppressed support each other? When the Obama administration came into power, the U.S. diplomats called on Israel to freeze settlements. Posters sprang up on Tel Aviv walls depicting Obama wearing an Arab headdress called a kafia and emblazoned with the words Jew-hater and anti-Semite. This for Barack Hussein Obama, who swore to AIPAC before election to do everything and anything to protect and defend Israel. Neither Angela Davis nor Mark Lamont Hill are anti-Semitic. They are anti-racist, anti-oppression, and anti-imperialist. And no one has the right to tell any oppressed people who they may or may not support. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Qui a toujours été la voix des opprimés et de la classe ouvrière depuis plus d'un siècle. Contrairement à la presse bourgeoise, la Humanité et le journal de Pôle, pour celui des gouvernantes, est-il a toujours donné la priorité à ceux qui se battent pour la liberté, l'émancipation et la dignité. C'est un trésor national et mondial dont l'avenir doit être aussi radio que le passé. Moi, comme nous tous, soutenons la Humanité. C'est Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
The motives behind the removal by foreign forces of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide back in February of 2004? How did the Clintons' supposed philanthropic initiatives enhance the family's own fortunes and contribute to the corruption of the Haitian state? Why are Canadian special forces on the ground today in the midst of popular uprisings? Did a Quebec engineering firm currently at the center of a political scandal in Ottawa play a unique role in Haiti and in setting Canadian foreign policy generally? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a special look at the ongoing strife affecting the people of Haiti and probe the underlying dynamics motivating the UN, American, and Canadian actors to continue the repression of this historically significant Caribbean island nation. First, we'll get some of the historical and geopolitical background from Haitian-Canadian organizer and writer Jean Saville. Later in the hour, we'll hear specifically about Canada's role and motivations in the Haitian coup and ongoing occupation with Yves Engler. On this week's program, the coup against President Aristide, 15 years later, the Clintons, the Canadians, and Western NGOs all complicit in a never-ending tragedy. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 1st, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of Nahiowak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The outflow of dollars from Venezuela has raised the value of dollars that remain in Venezuela on the black market there, thereby helping to depress the value of the bolivar in Venezuela even further. These measures pale, however, to U.S. imperial efforts to prevent Venezuela from obtaining dollars in global markets in an effort to try to offset the outflow of dollars from the economy. For example, the U.S. has taken action to prevent U.S. and global banks from lending dollars to Venezuela or from participating in underwriting and insuring Venezuelan bond issues, which would also raise dollars for Venezuela if allowed. Bank loans and bond funding thus dry up, depriving the government of alternative sources of dollars. More dollar shortage, more bolivar domestic currency collapse, i.e., more expensive imports, more inflation, more shortages, declining production, rising unemployment, more discontent. That comes from the article Financial Imperialism, The Case of Venezuela by Dr. Jack Rasmus, posted February 28th, originally appearing on the author's blog, jackrasmus.com. In 1986, the International Court of Justice, in adjudicating the Republic of Nicaragua versus the United States of America, held that the U.S. had violated international law by supporting the Contras in their rebellion against the Nicaraguan government and by mining Nicaragua's harbors. Never mind that the United States refused to participate in the proceedings after the court rejected its argument that the ICJ lacked jurisdiction to hear the case. Never mind that U.S. also blocked enforcement of the judgment by the United Nations Security Council and thereby prevented Nicaragua from obtaining any compensation. The General Assembly voted twice in favor of a resolution calling for full and immediate compliance with the judgment, with only Israel voting against with the USA. But more importantly, probably because of the great attention the U.S. conviction received in the court of public opinion, the U.S. stopped mining Nicaragua's harbors and lessened outright support for the Contras' murderous attacks. The Venezuela government must sue the United States in the International Court of Justice for creating famine by and blocking all its oil sales and stealing its bank deposits. That comes from the article, Economic Sabotage and Crimes Against Humanity. Venezuela must sue the U.S. at the International Court. By Jay Jansen, posted February 28th, originally published on the Gion Journal. Japan seems to want to become more than an ally of the U.S. It wants to become, again, a power in the world in its own right. Until it has achieved its objective of again being a world power, it can be expected to be a loyal ally to the USA and therefore a threat to Russia. It will not ask the US to withdraw its forces until it is ready, and the Russian government would face serious problems on the domestic front if it surrendered the islands to Japan under these conditions, so it is unlikely that a peace treaty can be concluded between Russia and Japan in the near future. So, as North Korea, having suffered decades of Japanese military occupation, tries to deal with U.S. militarism in the region, Russia has to contend with both U.S. existing militarism and a rising Japanese militarism, both of which constitute threats to its peace and security, a result of unfinished business from a world war that threatens a new world war. That comes from the article, Russia, Japan, and the USA, The Unfinished Business of War, by Christopher Black. Posted February 28th, originally published at New Eastern Outlook. Assad and legitimate associated armed forces are protecting Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, not destroying it, as Western Newspeak would have us believe. President Maduro, too, was democratically elected. The Western supported aspiring puppet dictator Guaido, on the other hand, appointed himself interim president with Washington's blessing. He didn't even run for the office of president. Government and media messaging that suggests that he is a legitimate alternative to President Maduro amounts to war propaganda and is part of a conspiracy to destroy Venezuela and impose the death sentence on countless Venezuelans should an invasion occur, just as the regime change war against Syria has imposed death and disaster upon countless innocent Syrians. That comes from the article, Who Are the Brutal Dictators? By Mark Taliano, posted February 28th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In early February 2004, a paramilitary rebel army had crossed the border from the neighboring Dominican Republic and executed an armed insurgency of Haiti. The 2004 insurgency set the stage for the February 29th kidnapping, abduction, and deportation of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide by U.S. Marines acting in conjunction with Canadian and French military forces. What followed was a 15-year occupation by foreign actors, the installation of a U.S. puppet government in Port-au-Prince, the country's capital, and massive violence directed against the poor majority. To put this operation and its aftermath in its proper context, the Global Research NewsHour reached out to Jean Saville. He is an Ottawa-based writer and activist and the co-founder of the Canada-Haiti Action Network. As I understand it, you were in Haiti a few weeks before the removal of Aristide. What are your recollections of Haitian society at that time?
Well, I think Haiti at that time kind of looked like how people are watching Venezuela today, in a sense that you had a popular president who was clearly supported by the vast majority of the citizens of the country. However, his support was from individuals who are powerful by the number. However, in terms of financial capacity, they were the poorest in the country. And the minority in Haiti had the strong support of foreign powers, mostly the embassies of European countries, the United States, and Canada in Haiti, who were hell-bent on fomenting unrest in Haiti, strangulating the legal government, and at the same time giving a lot of airtime to the so-called opposition in Haiti that was calling for the overthrow of the government. And there were two groups, two faces of the same group, one that was supposed to be a legitimate opposition that was composed of party leaders, and then there was what they called the rebels. These are drug dealers, mercenaries that were being trained by the CIA in the neighboring Dominican Republic, and they've been doing attacks on the territory of Haiti sporadically, arriving by way of the Dominican Republic and attacking police stations, and it got to a very dangerous tone by the end of 2003 when several individuals had been killed. But in the mainstream media of the United States, Canada, and Europe, you would never know this was what was happening because the coverage was all very much one-sided, and the rhetoric of a black dictator who's, you know, misruling his country was what was being propagated throughout the airwaves. And I remember how frustrating it was for those of us who were watching what was happening from the press releases that were coming from the embassies, the consular warnings saying that Haiti is a dangerous place, don't go there, etc. Meanwhile, the context is that Haiti was approaching the celebration of the bicentennial of the end of racial slavery and the Declaration of Independence of Haiti on January 1st, 2004.
The first successful slave revolt in the Western Hemisphere.
Yes, the only known revolt of enslaved individuals that was completely successful in that they chased out the slavers and created a government of their own. It should have been a moment of celebration for humanity because, of course, the Haitian Revolution was very influential in terms of what happened to the rest of the Americas, not only in terms of the United States being able to more than double its size by purchasing Louisiana from the French, who once they realized they were going to lose the colony of Saint-Domingue, then sold Louisiana to Thomas Jefferson for a very, very cheap price. But also for Latin America, where the Latin America liberators, Francisco de Miranda and Bolivar, both came to Haiti in 1806, and then Bolivar came in 1812, sorry, and they all got support from Haiti in terms of human beings who went and fought as soldiers alongside the Latin Americans, weapons, even the very flag of Latin America that is very popular, what was then called the Greater Colombia, where you can see the red and blue of Haiti, and they add to it the yellow. That's the flag today of Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, etc. And that initial flag was actually created with Haitian fabric in the city of Jacmel in southern Haiti. And that is, again, to contribute to the emancipation of human beings who have been enslaved on the continent since the arrival of Christopher Columbus in 1492. And the only demand that the Haitians ever made of Latin American liberators is that wherever they go and conquer, they should free the enslaved individuals, which did not happen. They did not honor that. However, you can see in modern times, leaders such as Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, who tried to make amends of this for this by supporting the struggling Haitian democracy, notably with the Petrocaribe program that Hugo Chavez had started before he passed away.
Mm. Now, going back to the 1980s, there were imposed on the Haitian people these IMF structural adjustment programs and on all the impacts that brought about. And we ended up with Aristide. And I know that a lot of the discussion that we've heard with regard to Aristide, it focuses on the individual there and not really acknowledging the social conditions that gave rise to Mr. Aristide.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And of course, it seems like in the United States, there was a consensus that Haiti had to become the control. For people who do science, you know that in science, you must have a control that is this common denominator that is in the case of when you talk about labor, basically they've decided that Haiti has to be the cheapest labor in the region. What was making the system viable is that the Americans, using the dictatorship of Duvalier, was able to maintain the population in fear and through repression. And the United States helped François Duvalier, what they call Papa Doc, establish the famous or infamous Tonton Macoute. It is it's like CIA agents who went into Haiti and established that group. And later on, when his son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, took over in 1971 at the age of 19, they trained another group called the Leopards with the same mission. These groups, including the so-called Force Armée d'Haïti, or the Army, never shot at foreign forces or foreign troops, invaders, or anything like that. Their enemy, as they were taught at the School of Americas, at Fort Bragg and all of these military schools that the Americans were managing and producing militaries for Latin America in general, but in Haiti in particular, their enemy was clearly identified as the masses, the population. And so that was the formula, and that is still the formula, to make sure that the resources of Haiti are accessible to multinational corporations, whether it is for sweatshops, whether it is for mining, because it's now been discovered that there's a lot of gold that has not yet been mined in Haiti. But the idea it would be to establish a dictatorship that is friendly to the multinational corporations and that is willing to placate the population in order to keep them subdued by any means necessary, working essentially as their ancestors did before.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was in the period since the coup, you had these UN, so-called peacekeepers on the ground who were, in fact, they were doing what they could to direct or to counter Lavalas and Aristide supporters very violently, as it turns out. And then at the point where we had the earthquake, then there was this influx of foreign aid, and you have the Red Cross and the Clintons in there, mm-hmm. And it seems like with all of that aid that went in, very little of it actually went to the target population. I wonder if you could comment on that whole period is essentially an execution of this imperial program, if you will. I wonder if you could talk about how that evolved.
Yeah. So I think first we need to address a couple of misconceptions. Sometimes in the mainstream media, because coverage of Haiti really rarely goes deep, people assume that the United Nations troops went there as a result of the earthquake, you know, to bring aid or whatever. This is not the case. The United Nations troops were deployed, as you pointed out, in 2004 to give cover to the coup. So they started to have this discourse that, you know, the global community is coming to the rescue of the Haitians, which is nothing new, really, because the U.S. occupation of 1915 had that same rhetoric. You know, that, you know, we're going in there. In National Geographic, for instance, they had a quote from the U.S. Marine saying that we're going in there to help our black brother put his disorderly house in order. You know, the white man to the rescue.
White man's burden.
yes. And it's not that different in terms of how they justified it in 2004, except that it was difficult for them to explain why would you have troops going from the United Nations where you call for Chapter 7 intervention when there is no war. This is the only time in history it has ever happened that you have deployment of UN troops under Chapter 7, which gives them authority to use force against a so-called enemy. But in the case of Haiti, who is that enemy? Because there was no military force in Haiti. The so-called Haitian armed forces was disbanded back in 1995. So the United Nations resolution that was taken in 2004 was completely illegal. Nevertheless, they landed in Haiti in June 2004 and took over. Of course, they did not call it a military intervention. They didn't call it an occupation. And so they established a puppet regime in Haiti. And so to this day, what we have is a situation where the foreign powers have all the power, the effective power, in terms of deciding what happens in Haiti, and zero accountability. The second point I wanted to raise with regards to, you know, misconceptions that exist is the presence of the Clintons in Haiti, because also sometimes the presence of the Clintons is associated with the 2010 earthquake. The Clintons have been in Haiti way before that, of course. But in terms of Bill Clinton's role as special United Nations envoy to Haiti, this is as early as 2008 that he assumed that role while his wife, Hillary Clinton, was Secretary of State. Bill Clinton benefited from the fact that the earthquake happened in February 2010, because as he was already positioned in Haiti, they managed to lobby to have Bill Clinton become one of the key players in the movement to collect funds on behalf of Haitians. And so he became one of the two leads of something called CIIRH, the International Committee for the Reconstruction of Haiti, or something of the kind, and essentially collected over $10 billion in the name of Haitians. But
Several years later, people are still looking for the evidence of that money being used in Haiti, and it's just not there. And there were some investigations that Haitians were calling for, but eventually this became a hush-hush situation. And to this day, there's been no accountability. And that CIRH that Bill Clinton and the so-called Prime Minister of Haiti were co-leading just folded with no transparency as to what happened to the $10 billion that were to have been collected. You know, there was a lot of press conferences, as you know, after the earthquake, people promising all kinds of donations, contributions, etc. But what we know, though, is that Bill Clinton used that to peddle influence. And so, for instance, you end up having a his brother-in-law, Tony Rodham, sit on the board of directors of VCS Mining, one of the gold mining conglomerates who managed to have access to a large part of the Haitian territory, as they had by then established a puppet regime led by Michel Martelly, who negotiated those kind of sweet deals for Hillary Clinton. And in return, of course, Hillary Clinton was the person who entered Haiti during the process of an election in 2011. And you know, and insisted that Mr. Martelly be allowed to go to the second round when the electoral process had disqualified him because he didn't have enough votes to go to the second round. But Hillary Clinton insisted in having the results reversed, and reversed they were. It was such a scandalous situation that a highly ranked official of the Organization of American States, Ricardo Sentenfus, denounced this publicly, and he eventually wrote a book about it. But in response, the OAS basically took action to give this Brazilian some early retirement offers so that he couldn't challenge the Clintons, who had essentially intervene to rig the results of an election in Haiti. And this is why it's some kind of like a strange irony that later on it would be Hillary Clinton who is now crying foul with regard to the elections in the United States, that a foreign power had intervened in our election.
Jean, I've really appreciated the perspectives that you've brought to this, you know, this 15th anniversary.
What I have been doing on my end with a few activists in Ottawa is take the time to write to various prime ministers, including the current prime minister, and with a very single message. That is, we need to have a different. Or not different, actually, we need to establish normal relationships with Haiti. There's no need for this racial tension and all of that. What we need to have this stop is the same thing that was needed in 1791, where a few white idiots had in their mind that the 30,000 of them could keep exploiting 450,000 Africans by simply relying on the support of European forces, and therefore they can continue to, you know, live a lavish life while the vast majority rot in poverty. This is just stupid. The peace can be reestablished quite easily if it's not being a situation where hatred and poverty is being fueled by the powerful foreign embassy.
I've been speaking with Jean Saint-Ville. He is an Ottawa-based Haitian writer and activist. You can see more of his articles at the site jafrikayiti.com, and as mentioned on the Global Research website.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Canada, a country that continues to boast about its positive role in the world, had a very diabolical role in Haiti, both in the coup against Aristide, but also in the ongoing repression of democratic processes then and since. To share his insights, we're joined by Yves Engler, one of the country's foremost critics of Canada's foreign policy. He's authored 9 books on Canadian foreign policy, including Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, which he co-authored with Anthony Fenton. Yves joins us now from Montreal. Welcome back to the show, Yves.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Now, according to his own account, President Bertrand Aristide was rounded up by U.S. Marines on February 29th and sent to the Central African Republic. Canadian Special Forces were on the ground that day securing the airport, but Canada helped with the planning for the overthrow of Aristide more than a year previous. Can you share with our listeners what we now know about the Ottawa Initiative in Meech Lake and other efforts to undermine the elected Haitian president?
Yeah, I mean, we know that the Canadian government is involved militarily, through policing, through diplomatic support, to aid funding in the campaign to destabilize and overthrow Aristide's elected government in 2004. That led to thousands, not just Aristide, not just the president, but thousands of other elected officials across the country were ousted. And it also led to a brutal 2-year dictatorship that killed was responsible for thousands of deaths, and it has hurt Haitian politics right up until today in terms of sort of leading to greater foreign control of the country. And so, but going backwards to the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti, on January 31st and February 1st of 2003, Canadian government brought together high-level officials from the George W. Bush administration in the U.S., a minister from the French government, and officials from the Organization of American States, where they were to discuss Haiti's future. No officials from Haiti's government were invited to this meeting. As was reported on in L'Actualité, which is Quebec's most important news magazine, on March 15, 2003, at this meeting, they discussed the fact that Aristide should go, that Haiti should be put under UN trusteeship, and the Haitian military should be recreated. 13 months after this meeting, Aristide was forced out of the country by U.S. Marines with Canadian troops at the airport and French troops immediately invading the country. Haiti was essentially put under UN trusteeship for basically until very recently, where UN forces occupied the country. They still do, but in a much smaller number. And the Haitian military was partly recreated by bringing former Haitian military into the Haitian police, which was financed and overseen by the Canadian government. So basically, Canada was involved in I don't know if you would use the term plotting the coup. I think you could use that term, but clearly involved in consolidating the international forces, primarily the U.S., France, and Canada, that would perpetrate the coup. And Haitians are continuing to feel the consequences of that. Those Canadian decisions 15 years later.
Speaking about consolidating a consensus, strangely, counterintuitively, a number of progressive groups in Canada, including Alternative and a group of NGOs known as the Concentration pour Haiti, ironically, they assisted in the foreign occupation of Haiti, at least in terms of the narratives that were being put forward. What compelled those groups to prop up those narratives effectively in support of the elites in Haiti and abroad, to the detriment of the vulnerable people you would think they'd be advocating for?
Yeah, I mean, it goes beyond just basically most Quebec NGOs, a number of English Canadian NGOs to a lesser extent, as well as the major Quebec unions, Fédération des travailleurs et travailleuses du Québec, the main labor umbrella organization, CLC's counterpart in Quebec, they clearly supported the coup in their statements in the lead up to the coup, in their statements after the coup, and there's been many stories and reports written about detailing all the specifics of what they'd said and didn't say. But the explanation for the why is, I think, slightly complicated. Essentially important, of course, is the fact that these groups receive Canadian government funding, including the FTQ for their international operations. But the NGOs like Alternatives, Development and Peace, ACOSI, the main NGO umbrella group in Quebec, they all receive most of or significant shares of their funding from the Canadian government, and that Canadian government was very much supportive of the coup. Beyond that, these organizations were tied into the intellectual strata of Haitian society. Part of it is based actually on linguistics. So Quebec organizations, they have significant relations with Haiti, partly on the basis that they claim that Haiti is a French-speaking country. Now, of course, most people in Haiti do not speak French. Everyone in Haiti speaks Haitian, or what is often called Creole, maybe 10, possibly 20%, but even possibly less than 10% of the population speaks French. So Quebec organizations, when they interact with Haiti, and this goes long history of Quebec missionaries interacting with Haiti, they do so on the premise that Haiti is a French-speaking country. Now, in Haiti, language is very much a tool of class domination. It's the elite that speak French. They use that until very recently. One of the positive things that Aristide did was he valorized Creole at the expense of French, and that effectively undermined class rule. And so Quebec organizations, if they go to Haiti on the basis that it's a French-speaking country, they reinforce this linguistic class domination. And so basically Quebec NGOs were very much tied into a sort of strata of intellectual, not the business elite, but the intellectual elite of Haiti. And those sectors had very much moved away from Aristide and Aristide, who was still supported by the vast majority of the population, who, of course, are extremely poor. So there's a mix of Canadian government funding was central to explaining it. There's also some other particular dynamics in terms of language, in terms of how NGOs get oriented towards intellectual elites in impoverished countries. But the story of the role of NGOs and of supposed left organizations, the extent to which they played a damaging role in Haiti is a story that's a very important story, and Haiti is sort of the highest NGO per capita anywhere in the world. So it's a perfect place to look at some of the worst elements of how the whole system of foreign international NGOs leads to undermining sovereignty, leads to undermining a political struggle that I think is necessary to get a more equal world.
The Republic of NGOs, I guess, is what you'd call it. I mean, that points to some interesting dynamics. The role of foreign aid in, you know, with all the money that comes to it and the activities that can spur. I guess it's hard for a lot of these NGOs to turn that down because, I mean, they may have other valid activities in other countries, but in order to do the work that they want and need to do, they there may be a bit of a Faustian trade-off that undermines their mission.
Well, in the case of Alternatives, which was an NGO, you know, very much associated with the World Social Forum, somebody, an NGO that had people like Judy Rebick were on its board. They had an association with Naomi Klein. It was absolutely explicit. They did not operate in Haiti before the coup. They followed the massive influx of Canadian. Canadian aid funding after the coup. And they even, in one story I wrote about this, they even, at one point, the Harper government cut their funding. And the head of Alternatives complained, saying that, well, why are you cutting our funding when we're doing positive things in Haiti, Afghanistan, and Iraq? In all three of those cases, they follow, there's something that I've dubbed the aid intervention principle. So when U.S. or Canadian troops are killing people or occupying a place, there's generally an influx of Canadian aid. The clearest example of that was Afghanistan, Haiti, and Iraq were the main recipients of Canadian aid in the 2000s, the top three recipients of Canadian aid in the 2000s. And so the head of Alternatives actually, in one article he wrote, he complained that, hey, you're cutting our funding when we're doing such a good job in Haiti, Afghanistan, and Iraq. But basically, clearly associating their work with the, you know, imperial occupation efforts, and the organization, as when it's receiving 70% of its funding from the federal government, of course they have to be responsive to the desires of the federal government, and where the federal government is looking for more aid work, that's where Alternatives and other NGOs will go, because again they're getting their funding from the government, and if the government wants to support U.S. occupation of Haiti, Afghanistan, or Iraq, well, Alternatives will try to find something they can do if they're, you know, in those countries, if they're paid by the government to do it.
Now, you know, turning back to some of the particular ways in which Canada's been, you know, actively involved in, you know, undermining the democratic process, in your book, The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, there's a section where the name Jean-Pierre Kingsley comes up. He is the former head of Elections Canada, but he was also involved in a group that played a role in overseeing and influencing the Haitian elections, the International Foundation of Election Systems. What have you been able to determine about how those, you know, supposed watchdogs effectively involved themselves in the democratic mechanisms within Haiti?
Well, there was a report about 10 months after the coup from the University of Miami that went into IFAS and their role in supporting opposition groups within Haiti, and they received significant funding from the U.S. government. A little bit of funding, I believe, from the Canadian government for building up opposition to the Aristide government. That was detailed in that report. And Jean-Pierre Kingsley specifically he headed up the oversight of the Electoral Commission in the election after the coup in 2006. And the election itself was a totally fraudulent affair. Fami Lavalas, political party of Aristide, the popular political party of the country, was not allowed to participate in those elections. So just overseeing them was giving a sort of a stamp of approval to this very dubious affair. But then more specifically, even once the election happened, and basically René Préval, joined the election late. He was a former president. He had been Aristide's prime minister. He was somebody who was viewed as not going to just follow Washington's line. He entered the election, and he clearly won the election by a large margin. But there was an effort to tamper with the vote, and there was actually even a situation where like thousands of ballots were found burnt. Which led to massive protests. Despite clear efforts at rigging the election, Kingsley put out a statement at the time supporting the election, and even elements of the coup government's electoral council were not willing to endorse the election. And here you had the head of Elections Canada, fully endorsing it. And then after he left his position in Elections Canada, he, Jean-Pierre Kingsley, went to work for IFAS. I believe he headed up the organization. So you really, you know, in the case of the coup in Haiti, you really had all elements of the Canadian state and Canadian political life supporting the coup, from NGOs to Elections Canada to the Canadian military to the Canadian police, RCMP, Sûreté du Québec, to the Canadian aid agency funding it, to Canadian diplomats. to obviously the corporate media and the dominant media, providing justifications and huge amounts of propaganda about what was happening. But the instance of Elections Canada, and particularly Jean-Pierre Kingsley, was just one piece of this sort of multifaceted Canadian assaults against Haitians, really. And it's one that hasn't actually, unfortunately, ended right up until today.
I noticed that there was an article that you put out on February 22nd, the Canadian military in Haiti. Why? And it talks about Canadian troops having been deployed to Haiti without the consent of the public or a parliamentary vote. And you bring up an outfit that that you refer to, or that's referred to as the Canadian Special Operations Forces Command, overseeing these patrols on the streets. Could you give us, what insights you have about what those people are doing there, and under what authority they can be present there?
Well, there's two parts. First of all, people may have been maybe aware that as of February 7th, there was massive demonstration, general strike, paralyzed most of urban area of Haiti, particularly in Port-au-Prince, but in the smaller cities as well. And that general strike went on for almost 10 days. There still continue to be protests, but the actual general strike seems to have been broken. Now, there was a great deal of repression. Dozens of people were killed in those protests by the police. The general strike of February 7th follows on massive protests in October, November, and actually even bigger protests in the summer. In the summer, protesters were able to have the prime minister fall, and the recent protests have been calling for the illegitimate president to go, partly tied around corruption and the current president and his predecessor, which are from the same party, that they had embezzled hundreds of millions, maybe into billions of dollars of money from the Petrocaribe Fund, the fund that the Venezuelan government set up in 2006, actually began it with the Preval government, that gave Haiti and some other Caribbean countries oil at discounted prices, which was supposed to be then used to fund social programs and infrastructure and whatnot. And the Martelly government and the Jovenel Moïse current government, Martelly being previous government, appear to have embezzled huge amounts of money. So there have been major protests calling for the removal of Jovenel Moïse, the president, and it's almost all of Haitian society seems to be behind these protests. Even the slums have been, poor neighborhoods have been calling for the removal of Moïse since before he was quote-unquote elected. It was only 18% of the population that participated in the election, the so-called election, and all kinds of fraud. So in this context of massive popular uprising against this government, there have been, as I mentioned, police have been killing protesters, dozens of people killed over the past couple weeks, but also even dozens more in the previous months. Some of this has been documented. There was a terrible massacre in La Saline, a poor neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, back in November. In this context, Canadian Special Forces were deployed to Haiti, and they were photographed at the Port-au-Prince airport on February 15th. According to Haiti Information Project, that photographed the Canadian, at least one Canadian troop with, in full gear with the M16, and then a couple of Canadian troops in plain clothes. I asked the preeminent journalist on the Canadian military whether who he thought these Canadian troops were that were photographed. He told me he thought they were Joint Task Force 2, which is the Canadian Special Forces, the elite of the elite of the Canadian Special Forces, and that one of them was probably another element of Canadian Special Forces. None of this was discussed. There's no Canadian media that has, to my understanding, mentioned the fact there were Canadian troops sent to Haiti. So this was done in total secrecy, though, again, it's been, you know, documented. And so the question becomes, why were they deployed? And it seems pretty clear to me that either indirectly or directly, they were deployed to support this unpopular government that was facing a general strike, demanding it go. According to the Haiti Information Project, they believe that the Canadian troops were actually helping the family members of the government to flee the country because it was a lot of instability, major protests. The deployment of Canadian troops fits alongside the recent Canadian diplomatic support for Jovenel Moïse, and Canadian officials have Trudeau met with the Prime Minister in December amidst these massive protests. Canada's part of the so-called core group of Friends of Haiti that have put out all these, with the U.S., France, and a couple other countries, that have put out these statements supporting the government despite these massive protests. Canada's been financing the Haitian police. Canadian ambassador has been has this photos on his Twitter account of attending ceremonies for the Haitian police that have been responsible for firing on the protests. But I don't have any answer. I don't know exactly why they were deployed, but we know that there were Canadian Special Forces deployed to the Polar Plains Airport amidst this massive popular uprising, and there's been absolutely no mention about it in Canadian Parliament and Canadian media. And of course, this fits with what we know about the Joint Task Force 2 and Canadian Special Forces. Part of why they are desirable from the government's perspective is because they don't have to divulge any information about them. Almost everything about them is secret. Only find out what they want to release to the media. And so the Canadian government can deploy these JTF2 forces, and the public is none the wiser. And there's stories of them being deployed in all kinds of very questionable political ways, including, of course, on the night that Aristide said he was overthrown, on February 29th, 2004, when U.S. Marines took him to the airport in Port-au-Prince. There were, according to a number of different media reports, there were 30 Canadian troops, including snipers on the roof of the airport, securing the airport, while the elected president says he was kidnapped by U.S. Marines and dumped in the Central African Republic.
I wanted to bring up with you the question of SNC-Lavalin, because that's this engineering firm in Quebec that's been in the news very much lately in relation to a scandal which could lead to the downfall of the prime ministership of Justin Trudeau, if not the entire Liberal government. He apparently, the prime minister's office attempted to put pressure on this attorney general, Jody Wilson-Raybould, to basically offer a kind of plea deal that would remediate this company in the wake of corruption charges that stemming back several years, and basically not prevent them from bidding on other contracts. I believe there's a lot more to this story than simply the way it's portrayed currently in the media is just sort of like partisan cronyism and that whole just trying to get votes in Quebec. Could you please talk a little bit about SNC-Lavalin and its involvement in Haiti during the post-coup years and for that matter, some of the other things that it's been doing in the world that are quite relevant?
Yeah, I mean, SNC-Lavalin is Canada's leading disaster capitalist firm. Halliburton's kind of like Canada's Halliburton, which received a lot of attention after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The sun never sets on SNC-Lavalin. They have operations all around the world, most countries they operate in, and they were heavily involved in reconstruction after the coup of 2004. They had a number of projects paid for by the Canadian Aid Agency in Haiti. Also, they helped build the big Canadian embassy that was built right after the 2004 coup. In Port-au-Prince. To the extent the media provides some sort of critical stuff about SNC, it sort of talks about how SNC has been lobbying Liberal government officials to avoid a court case, and they just want to pay a fine, and they don't want to be blacklisted by Canadian government. They're already blacklisted by the World Bank for funding for, I believe, for a decade. This is a company that is its roots and its dependence on Canadian government support are long-standing. It's right at the core, right at the center of Canadian foreign policy. You go back to the early 60s, they began in India with a project financed by the Canadian International, or the predecessor of the Canadian International Development Agency. They ran Canadian diplomatic outposts in some former French colonies after independence. The countries that Canada didn't have diplomatic outposts, they were financed by CETA for that. They have projects. They were the ones responsible for the big dam, the signature dam project in Afghanistan during the Canadian occupation in Kandahar, a $15 million project. They actually had a $700 million project running the Canadian base with the U.S. Company in Kandahar. This is a company that is deeply tied into Canadian foreign policy. Yes, the lobbying visits of SNC officials, I'm sure, had some influence over liberal policy in terms of trying to help them out. But the relationship of SNC and their ties to the Canadian state and you know, former official Canadian government officials go work for SNC, and you know, back there's the back and forth that goes on. This is something that's very deeply rooted, and it's a company that's just the number of controversial projects that they have been part of is all kind of almost endless. You know, from the Three Gorges Dam in China in the 1980s to providing bullets to the American occupation of Iraq. In 2004, they got a huge contract to provide bullets to the American military because the American military was using so many bullets in Iraq. Their nuclear, they have a nuclear component, on and on and on. So SNC is a company that has very much benefited from Canadian foreign policy, Canadian aid policy, and it's obviously a very powerful company in terms of shaping Canadian foreign policy. And there's actually one other element that's kind of interesting that's not been mentioned. I mean, they've been caught bribing and involved in corruption in innumerable countries across Africa and Bangladesh and all across the world. This, you know, of examples that have been proven. One element that I haven't seen mentioned about this is this is actually partly an outgrowth of Canadian government policy, because Canada until very recently has had the most lax regulations around international bribery of Canadian companies. The U.S. brought in legislation back in 1977 that to hold companies, American companies, responsible domestically if they're caught in bribing abroad. I actually have a quote from the former head of Lavalin, which merged, SNC and Lavalin merged, and talking about how they were better placed than American companies to provide bribes because it was legal in Canada right until the 90s. And it wasn't until like 2011 that the Canadian government was basically pressured by the G7 initiatives to bring in some corruption rules around Canadian companies abroad. But it wasn't until like 2011 that the RCMP finally pursued its first effort at a Canadian company for bribing abroad. So even SNC's sort of role in international corruption and bribing, that's really sort of an outgrowth of the lax legislation in this country around Canadian companies bribing abroad. And they literally could just write it off. That was until the 1990s, early 90s, how companies were able to just write off their international bribes as part of business expenditures. There's a whole story about SNC that's you know, not being pursued in this sort of scandal focused media attention of what we got going on with Trudeau right now.
Eve, it's always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us once again.
Thanks a lot for having me, Mike.
We've been speaking with Eve Engler, a Canadian foreign policy critic and author of several books, including Canada in Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority from 2005. You can find more of his writing at the website, YvesEngler.com. That's YvesEngler.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.